It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. What a show we have. Talk about brain power. Ben Thompson from Stratechery, Ed Bott from ZDNet, Renee Ritchie from iMore. And we are going to dissect bit by bit everything Apple announced on Wednesday, what it all means. We might even get in some talk about Twitter. And yes, John McAfee is running for president. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 527, recorded Sunday, September 13th, 2015. Synergy is for sheep. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service that's the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/twit to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/twit. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one easy integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions, fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/twit. And by Gazelle. Would you like to get cash for your old iPhone? Gazelle makes it easy. The shipping is free and the payment is fast. What's your iPhone worth? Find out at Gazelle.com. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the best way to create a beautiful website or online store. Enter the offer code TWIT and get 10% off Squarespace. Build it beautiful. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Big show today. Great studio audience. Thank you all for being here. And this is going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be like a version of kind of computer crossfire. On the left, Ed Bott, joining us from ZDNet. Great to see you, Ed.
Always happy to be on the left, Leo.
good friend, and always welcome to the show. On the right, Renee Ritchie from iMore.com. He hosts many shows on iMore and also, of course, Mac Break Weekly. Great to see you, Renee. You're back.
Absolutely. I'm back in the nicely air-conditioned Montreal and away from your heat wave.
And then from all the way from Taiwan, Ben Thompson of Stratechery. Great to have you, Ben.
Great to be here.
Early morning. Good to get up
it
early.
Is, but I'm this weird weird middle thing. Because I was in San Francisco last week. But while there, I tried to stay on Taiwan time. And I halfway succeeded. So I've been kind of in halfway time.
Oh, you both must there be. And you're here just messed since. Up. That's it. You're just shocked.
Ben and I were at a Japanese whiskey bar until very late at night.
Oh, what fun.
San Francisco, so I don't know how he's doing this today.
Oh, what fun. That's awesome. Well, I think anybody who's tuned in today knows that probably... Most of the conversation will be about Apple's event. Although John McAfee is running for president, and I think that there is something to be said there, but we'll talk about that a little bit later on. You were at the Apple event, Ben, I take it? That's why you were in the Bay Area?
It turned out I actually had something else going on. It's hard to justify flying over just for the Apple event, but it turned out I had two events in 1 week, so it worked out perfectly.
Good.
So, yes, I was there.
It's true. You can watch now the stream. Thank you, Apple, for streaming.
Right.
That.
No, exactly.
Yeah. And I know, Renee, you were there. And, of course, the real advantage of going is the hands-on, because that's the only way you can touch this new
exactly.
stuff.
Yep.
So before the event, we talked a little bit about this on Mac Break Weekly. There was some discord in the Apple press community. There were those like John Pachkowski of BuzzFeed and Mark Gurman of 9to5Mac who said, no, they're going to announce an iPad. And then those like John Gruber said, they can't possibly announce an iPad. The event would be too long. Well, they were both right. The event was too long, and they announced the iPad. Almost 2.5 hours, if you include One Zing. Direction. Say again?
Zing.
Zing. They were both right. I was shocked because normally Apple begins these events with a discussion of sales, how well the stores are doing, how many people use iPhones. And we knew it had to be an iPhone event. They've got to announce a new iPhone. But they buried that right at the back. They opened with watchOS 2.0. And weirdly, these Hermes, it looks like what do you call it? B&D band. It was a double wrap, kind of like leather.
I think it's called the double tour.
Double tour. Yeah, pardon moi.
A double tour.
Pardonnez moi.
Yes, to say it correctly.
That wasn't One Direction. It was One Republic. I'm so sorry.
We keep making that. Yeah, everyone's making that.
Is there a distinction?
One's a boy band and one's a boy band.
Okay, that's the problem I'm having. But Harry is in One Direction, not One Republic.
Right. If it had been One Direction, that would have been more humorous, because one of the rumors is that Taylor Swift was going to perform.
Oh.
And so had Harry Styles showed up. But
yeah, her ex.
I'm showing way too much familiarity.
I can't believe you know this. In fact, I can't believe I know this. So.
This is why Sir Tekkery is so on point.
you got to stay in touch with what's going on.
So they talked about the watch. Then they went right to the iPad Pro, long rumored. In fact, there was nothing really in these announcements that we didn't already know from the rumors.
Yeah, sites. So the thing with this is that, like, what to me is always not the interesting thing. It's how and why that's the interesting thing. Like you, iPad Pro has been in the works for years. The new Apple TV has been in the works for years. And all the stuff here, they've been working on it for years. But what they choose to ship and what the reason, the rationale they give behind it is what makes the events interesting to me.
Good.
Yeah, well, I think that's the challenge. I think that was something that why Gruber was suspicious of the time going on. I actually tweeted because Tim Cook said the biggest news in iPad. I said the biggest news in iPad is that Gruber was wrong. but I think what I actually thought the event was as a production was quite good. One of the better ones Apple's done in quite a while. And despite the fact there was so much in there and was relatively long, it was quite tight. But what was missing was one of my favorite post jobs keynotes is the iPhone 5S keynote and 5C. And this is when there's all Apple's going to have a low-cost phone and they have to get a low-cost phone. All this is kind of the big thing going on. And Apple came out starting to talk about the iTunes Music Festival. They had this highly produced video that was really compelling. And basically, if you step back and look at the presentation as a whole, was making the case that Apple's saying, no, we're not going to compete on price. We're going to compete on delivering an entire experience that covers all these sorts of things. And in that context, it made the phone delivery much more compelling. And that's what gets lost when you have these events with all these things in it. There was no real context around a lot of this stuff.
So what you're saying is subtext is what's important in these events.
Some sort of text.
What is the what is the subtext of Wednesday's announcement?
Well, I mean, if anything, it was, we're firing on all cylinders from a new product perspective. I mean, the sheer amount of stuff that was introduced was, pretty overwhelming in some respects. But the sort of big picture, where does this fit in what we're doing, what we care about, that was by necessity absent.
You know, it's funny because there are really a couple of different audiences for any Apple event. There's us,
yeah.
The app over involved Apple press. There is the person who buys Apple stuff and wants to know what the next thing is so they can decide whether to buy it. And then there's the rest of the world. I was in New York City. I felt terrible. Like, this first Apple event I've missed in a long time. And I'm looking around and I'm in a cab. Nobody's listening to the Apple event on the radio. Nobody's even taken any notice of it at all. They're living their life. They don't understand. It's the most important day of the year and they don't seem to know.
Well, that's why the context is important, though, because, yes, the biggest audience is, well, first off, journalists. And now that it's streaming, that's expanded. Right. And maybe that's changed their thinking about it. But this is their real chance to kind of shape the messaging around their products and what they do. And that's something they didn't take advantage of. Without there being that sort of context and how you should think about this sort of stuff, that's exactly what I mean by what is gone now. And maybe part of it is because it's streamed now. And I think they had 40 million or something like that. I mean, yeah, maybe it wasn't your cab driver, but, it's kind of like the whole, we don't need to do Macworld because we have stores,
right,
sort of argument, whether you buy it or not.
Yeah, and there was another issue here, too, and that's sort of what I think through John, and not to defend him because he doesn't need it, but most years they have two events. They have the iPhone plus something event and then the iPad and Mac event. And once it was decided they weren't going to have the October event, that this was going to be the only event in the fall, then everything that's ready has to fire, and anything that's not, stage-worthy just gets dropped in a press release. So the context for this is not one overarching thing like music, and here's all the stuff you can do with music, but it's these are the products we're announcing this year, and how are we going to sort of put those into chapters in this event?
Ed Bott, of course, mostly you cover Windows in ZDNet blog. And I'm looking at this, and I almost can wear two hats.
Me too, for the record.
If I'm the cynic, I look at this and I say, in every respect, this is Apple playing catch up. They're making a Surface Pro analog. They're finally, they're making an Apple TV, which is basically a Nintendo Wii combined with maybe a Fire TV. They're making phones that, finally have 12 megapixel camera. They're kind of the last one still making an 8 megapixel camera. If there's one context you can look at this and where you just say, well, this is Apple playing catch up. There's nothing innovative here. Of course, there's a second context, which we Apple enthusiasts embrace, where we're trying to really understand something that there's more important. What's your take on it, Ed? What did you think overall?
Well, this looks to me like the coming out of a company that is in full maturity. Everything that they showed at the event was incremental. And yet, a positive improvement. They don't have to convince their market to go and buy stuff. They don't have to come out with magical and revolutionary things to try to expand the market right now. They already have a very loyal following. They already have product cycles that they've settled into very nicely. And so these are all the logical progressions of every single product that they have in their product line. So it's and even the Hermes stuff is an extension of their desire to become identified as a luxury brand. And so that was they started that with the Watch Edition, and now they're starting to put other brands on top of it. This, to me, is not just a company that is sort of secure in its products, but that is and not just firing on all cylinders, but that has this steady, almost monotonous pipeline of products that it doesn't really have to sell very hard anymore because its audience understands what they're going to do.
But if you look at the rhetoric, they're trying to convince people that, well, look at the tagline for the iPhone 6S. The only thing that's changed is everything.
That's sort of a joke, though.
Like, for it's the, not really the true. This,
all the S phones are always said to be like, they're boring. They're just an incremental upgrade. So Apple's sort of playing on that to make fun of themselves before anybody else can.
Oh, so they're making fun of themselves?
Well, yeah, so it's like the idea was the iPhone 4S came out, oh, it's boring, it's the same. And the iPhone 5S came out, oh, it's boring, it's the same. So Apple's saying up front, the only thing, like, we know it's the same, but everything else has changed. So I think it's an attempt to own that, but that meme.
The only thing that's changed everything is actually a lie. It is not. It looks exactly the same.
Sure, but it's got different aluminum, different glass, different.
Oh, yeah, well, now we're using aluminum 7,000 instead of 6,000.
Well, it makes sense in context, Leo.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you a chance to make them to be fair because I'm being unfair. I know. Then on the Apple TV, the future of television, I think you can make a strong case. This is actually the past of television finally catching up to the present of television.
So it's entirely perspective based. If you look at Apple, they weren't the first to the phone. They weren't the first to the iPad. They played catch up in both those areas. That's sort of their game. Very rarely are they first to market. Usually they wait. They try to see what's in the market, what pain people are expressing. Then they very carefully pick their shots. And they waited a long time for the Apple TV because they were already in that market. But doing things like the iPad Pro with the keyboard, for a lot of people, this is going to... Fairly or unfairly, there's an old joke like Nokia invented everything in 1812, but nobody saw it. And it's a similar thing. All these products have been introduced, but Apple's trying to make them mainstream.
And by the way, I'm putting on a very contrarian hat here.
That's your job, Leo.
Because I am actually very – I think there's one product that Apple announced that I think is actually a world changer. But I want to let you guys tease that out first. So Ben, you were going to say something?
I was just gonna make the point that if your reason to say that the 6S is the same is because it looks the same is to kind of fall into the stereotype of design is just how it looks.
But say that everything has changed is clearly not true.
I mean, since when has Apple's marketing been clearly 100% true?
Right, and just to be clear, I think Apple is having a hard time in recent years coming up with good marketing taglines.
They used all the superlatives, right?
All the good stuff.
Last year, wasn't it bigger than bigger?
Yeah, that's not so good either.
Bigger than big.
Which was, I think, there's two things that are going on here. Number one is I can imagine the marketing meeting where somebody just throws up their hands and says, oh, screw it. Yeah. You know, we got to come up with, is this the best we got? Fine. It's the best one on the whiteboard. Let's use it. And the other thing is they're doing a sort of time-tested technique, which is to, it's almost jujitsu marketing.
Right.
Take your weakness.
Right.
And make it a strength. So last year, their weakness was that they were finally, years after the rest of the market had started delivering phones that were the size that people wanted, they finally delivered a phone that was two phones that were big enough for people. So they come up with a slogan, bigger than bigger, saying it's not just bigger. Well, yes, it was. The major point was that it was bigger. Right. And this year, the only thing that's changed is everything. Well, actually, no. Everything has changed a little bit, but everything's a little bit better. And if you're in the market for a phone right now, this is your good choice from Apple.
And you're on fire. It's two for two great takes. Completely agree.
And it's kind of what Renee was saying, but there's a certain sense of irony when you say the only thing that's changed is everything. There's an ironic. It's jujitsu. I think that's a pretty good way to describe it.
I took it actually, maybe just because I think in the financial world and business world, but I took it as a direct kind of statement to Wall Street. I mean, that the big kind of concern around Apple and their stock right now is the comp problem, which is the year-over-year comparisons to last year, which were, you know, which was insane and clearly
impossible to sustain that kind of growth. The world, eventually you run out of humans.
Well, I mean, no, Apple doesn't have, I mean, that's the advantage of being an expensive device is Apple doesn't have the human problem. It has the,
price problem.
Right.
It's the affluent human problem.
Right. Which in some respects, there's something to be said for that. When you say that nothing has changed except everything, I think that's speaking to there's going to be a reason to buy. There's going to be a reason to upgrade. And what's interesting is actually, I thought the event was very compelling from reason to upgrade, but only partially because of the feature perspective, but also some of the financing stuff they talked about. I think actually the changes in carrier plans in the US is going to work hugely to Apple's benefit. I think the kind of the conventional wisdom that Apple wins because of subsidies is pretty sorely mistaken.
Even on stage, Apple's still quoting prices that are subsidized prices. I think they were loath to say at $650.
No,
I bought the 6S Plus, loaded. It was over $1,000.
Yeah, I mean, well, when they first showed the slide and it only showed the contract growing, everyone in the journal section was kind of like
snicker,
shaking their yeah, exactly. But they followed it right up with then they listed all the carriers like per month prices.
Okay,
and then they did their own upgrade plan, which is very interesting. So actually, I thought they were relatively transparent about it. Even though, yes, of course, they didn't show the.
They don't want to tell you how much it is because it is it's a really outrageously expensive.
Although on the other hand, I went to Apple's site to before the show today because I wanted to.
They're sold out.
I wanted to check out some of the details of their financing because I wasn't exactly clear on how that was going to work. And I was pleased to see that they're not quoting contract prices. They are quoting full retail prices and then the monthly contract prices on the 24-month installment. There was an asterisk on those, but it's still, $199, $299, $399 is not honest. And I didn't see that when I went to the website. So that was,
to be fair,
a little better.
A big problem that I have with this whole like Apple's going to lose once it's no longer subsidized thing is there's kind of this implicit like consumers are stupid argument here. And I do think consumers are lazy.
but they're not stupid.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, I don't think anyone we'll see. We'll see how it plays out, these new contracts thing. But I don't think that it's necessarily going to hurt Apple. And if anything, the additional flexibility and freedom to upgrade sooner and more quickly is going to help them. I mean, there's lots of forces in the market that are in the iPhone's favor right now. First and foremost of which is people are now buying their second or third smartphone. And the big thing is when you're buying your first smartphone, you didn't understand how important the smartphone was to you, right?
So now you're willing to pay more. I agree. Yeah.
Exactly. Because you realize that this is now the most important device in your life. And if there's one thing you're going to pay a premium for, makes sense that it's that thing. And yes, you say, Leo, 1,000 is a lot. Well, one, you're buying the total top of the line. But two, in the grand scheme of things, $1,000 is a lot less than, say, buying a BMW, right?
Or yeah, buying but a that's not what you should compare it to. You should compare it to, for instance, a Windows PC for $400.
No, but the point is that absolute numbers matter just as much as relative numbers. Yes, relatively speaking, a phone is much more important. Is much more an iPhone is much more expensive than a perfectly valid alternative.
Desktop computer. Yeah.
No, exactly. But the absolute premium of $400. Is a lot less than the absolute premium. If you want to buy the single best car, the absolute premium is massive. You want to buy the single best stove, you can think about your
modern. Apple's advantage here is that they're the only ones premium. Make the iPhone. They're the only ones who have a price for the iPhone. It's apples to oranges.
Samsung's not cheap, though.
No, but here's a Moto X, which is a fabulous phone for $450. So I think this is... On the one hand, this is a difficult thing for Apple because there are phones of equal quality that are half as much, but they're not iPhones because Apple can make an iPhone. So they have an advantage.
Well, in what respect are the equal quality? I mean, I like the Moto phones. I think they're quite good. I would be happy to use one. But it is inferior from a build quality perspective. It's inferior from an industrial design perspective. And it's inferior if you prefer iOS, which a lot of people, including myself, do. So I think people are a little too casual to throw out it's equal. It's good enough, and I get the good enough argument. You can certainly have a very fine and productive life with a Moto phone or a whole host of Android phones. But that doesn't mean that they're equal. And the fact of the matter is, in the consumer market, we see this in industry after industry after industry, people are willing to pay a premium for a superior product. And I think where tech kind of got its head wrapped around an axle is because tech grew up in the enterprise market. Enterprise market is very much a cost versus features, kind of like which one matters. And the user experience isn't really a factor in enterprise buying. It just isn't. And so I think a lot of people in tech learned the wrong lessons from that. And now we're in a consumer market. And actually, we should be looking at other consumer markets to understand consumer behavior, not look at tech's history.
Well, I think it's no accident that Apple's focused on fashion, because fashion is the number one consumer market where features are not the deciding factor. You price it based on some imaginary fashion.
How it makes you feel, Leo.
How it makes you feel. Thank you. Hey, one thing I do want to bring about the low monthly payment plan that Apple's offering. If you compare it to other plans from the carriers, because all of them in the U.S. do that now, it's fairly comparable, right?
If you're buying AppleCare, it's fairly comparable.
Yeah, but there is one little, you see this little one here. There's one little note that somebody brought up on the radio show that I was not aware of. You are required to activate this, quote, unlocked phone with one of the four major carriers before you take it home. You have
you're also be giving Chinese smugglers basically an interest-free loan.
Ah, so it's about Chinese smugglers.
Well, just smugglers in general. I mean, imagine because it actually because
I would like to buy an unlocked phone. I would love
to do the global market, right? The global market,
yeah.
AKA Chinese smugglers. The financing is quite aggressive, actually. I mean, because I think if you
but I have to pay AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, or Verizon an activation fee to make this like a $50 activation fee. That's kind of a hidden cost.
If you're switching carrier, like you might already have a SIM and you can just pop it in there. I mean, that's what I do. I buy unlocked every year and I just take my SIM and I stick it in the new phone.
And you activate the phone and then it's okay.
Yeah, there's no fee or anything. Yeah.
Okay.
I just do it out of spite for the carriers. I think you're right.
So I understand the motivation now. It's not that the carriers are saying, hey, Apple, we want that $50. It's that they're worried about smuggling or global market cross U.S. border sales. All right.
Yeah, well, I mean,
but for the consumer, there's something to pay attention to. This guy said, hey, I use Straight Talk. I want to buy an unlocked iPhone. I want to use their financing plan, but I have to activate it. When I asked Apple, they said, oh, yeah, you just activate it, and then you cancel the account.
Well, you can use other, if you want to go to Straight Talk, there's other things that you can do. This is an option that's provided for people who want to use the big
US carriers. It says iPhone activation with a national carrier, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, or Verizon, period.
If you're a straight talk, I mean, like, you can still just go buy it. I don't know if they have SIM-free phones available in the U.S. now. They do in Canada already. You can just go buy it.
They do, but you can't take advantage of this iPhone upgrade program.
Right. You can't get the financing. That's the deal there. And that financing comes with AppleCare, the cost of AppleCare built into it, and with, it's basically a royalty, an intellectual royalty almost to the carriers that's basically saying we're going to maintain our relationships with you, by insisting on this activation clause.
Yeah, that's what I wonder about. I mean, traditionally Apple's had the carriers by the short hairs, but for some reason they're really making you activate with one of the four national carriers on this.
No, I don't buy any argument that thinks that the carriers make Apple do anything. Apple says jump and the carriers are like, we're already up in the air. Do you want us to go higher? Yeah. I really think it's this sort of smuggling sort of thing. Like they want to limit it to the U.S. market.
But a smuggler's not going to do the installment plan.
No, and it's also simplicity, Leo. I mean, like, Apple wants one program that just goes everywhere, and they don't want to have to negotiate with every small carrier, and they don't have to have people at setup.
No, Apple has to do is say, here, an unlocked phone, not activated, not associated with any carrier. You're going to pay us $32 a month. We're going to work this out with the bank because you have to do that. That's how they do
it. Look, I'd love for it to be in Canada and the UK as well, but they're starting with this, and it's probably going to expand as time goes on.
One other thing I say, the pricing is pretty aggressive, I think, for the upgrade offer. Like Apple, if you add up the costs, it's basically the equivalent of buying it up front. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that
it's like a 0% loan, basically.
Exactly. Which is interesting in its own right. I mean, because if you technically calculate the time cost of money, like you're actually getting a better deal by doing the upgrade plan. But given that, I think that there's no premium in there to justify taking on any additional risk that's necessary. And the other thing too, I think to Renee's point, it's the first year. I think it'll be interesting to see. One, it's interesting to see how it actually plays out in the stores. The last thing the stores need is people having 30-minute appointments to do stuff. I mean, they're already a mess as it is.
That hurt the Apple Watch a lot, I think.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And then two, I'm very interested to see how it goes next year. Are people on the upgrade plan going to be able to get one first day still? And how's that going to go down? And how's it going to be organized? I just think that there's a lot of unknowns about this. But that said, that I don't think it doesn't change the fact that it's a very interesting development. And it's really moving Apple into being two things. One, there's always more money to be made in finance anywhere else. And two, although, like I said, they're not really making much interest here. But two, it's almost like you're subscribing to the iPhone. And once you are on this upgrade plan, it's very difficult to see you ever not buying an iPhone.
No, you're basically in. You're all in now.
And they get to resell the old.
This is like the lock-in of all lock-ins.
Right.
And they get to resell the old phones, which is lucrative in a lot of markets still, especially emerging markets.
They'll probably recover, a lot of that money. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the carriers are doing it.
2 hours in, the ordering started 12:01 a.m. Pacific time on September 12th. By 2 a.m., I'm looking at a website called iPhone-inventory.blogspot.com. They went out and they looked at the store. By 2 hours in, the iPhone 6 Plus pretty much out of stock. 3 to 4 weeks delivery time. You can get the little one, but everybody's getting the big one. And on the few that have delays on the little one, it's the rose, aka
yeah. There weren't that many rose gold ones. Same as there weren't that many gold ones last time.
Right.
I'm interested if the proportion is going to shift much to the Plus. I mean, because people don't
look at this.
The six was still a much bigger seller than the Plus by a significant margin.
Yeah, because what's missing here is we don't know what the availability is. Were there half as many 6 Pluses?
There's a popular misconception that big phones were actually popular before the big iPhone. They weren't, especially not in North America. The Note had a trivial market share, and more people were still buying iPhones than buying a lot of the bigger phones combined. And I think with the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, that began to shift. Again, Apple didn't invent the big phone, but they mainstreamed it. And now people are seeing that big phones aren't a concern.
No, I disagree with you, right?
Well, in your side of the word, they were popular, Ben. They were not popular in North America.
Right, but I think that was – I mean, people made this argument a lot that, Apple shouldn't make a big iPhone, blah, blah, blah. People wanted big iPhones. It just happened to be in some markets people wanted an iPhone more than they wanted a big phone. Like you said, in Asia, it was not even close.
Look at iPhone sales in China. 2 hours in on the pre-order. 2 to 3 week delay for the iPhone 6, 8, 3 to 4 week delay for the 6 Plus. Sold out in 2 hours. That is probably very good news for Apple, which had to, of course, reassure Tim Cook had to reassure the markets that despite economic woes in China, there was still a strong market. Right, Ben? I mean, this is good news for Apple.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think the China question is interesting because Apple is more exposed to China than any other company by any other tech company by a long
shot.
That's
where their growth is happening, right?
Right. They're exposed on both sides, on both the upside and the downside. That said, the headroom for China, for Apple in China, is absolutely massive. And there's just, even with the current slowdown, the number of people moving into a middle-class level of income, which, you know, and the iPhone is basically the thing to get once you can, is basically more than the population of the United States. And the even if there is a slowdown, there's so much slack in the system to take that up that I think Apple will probably be fine. It's a valid reason to be concerned, absolutely, because it is Apple's biggest growth market, or the growth market. But that said, I think that Cook's statement, which was odd for lots of reasons, but I think it was
he called a Jim Cramer, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going to China, going to a small village. It was an agrarian village. They made all their money on pears or something. I can't remember what it was their product was. And going into a house, giant screen TV. And our guide explained to me that each year there is a new consumer product that is the thing for the kind of aspirational middle class to have. It was air conditioners one year. It was big screen TVs. I think this is culturally really important to understand. So I take it, it's the iPhone that is the kind of the status symbol for the upwardly mobile in China this year and for the last couple of years.
There's whole like luxury component and stuff, but that's almost like a higher level up.
That's what I'm saying. This is kind of the aspiring middle class.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to the absolute price point I was making earlier. Like, this is like an iPhone. You can get an iPhone for $650, you can get the iPhone 5S now for $450. In China, it's a little more because there's import taxes and things like that. But the point is, you can have the best possible phone, particularly from a status perspective, for not that much money. I mean, a Louis Vuitton bag starts at what, $1,500? Yeah, more than that. Like a Chanel bag is $5,000. Yeah. I mean, so those are, from a status perspective, those are in the same class. And so you think about it, the fact that even, yes, an iPhone is much more expensive than an Android phone, but from an absolute cost basis, it's not that much. So in a country like China, like, of all the things you're going to get first when you arrive, like, the thing to get when you first arrive was a Louis Vuitton wallet. Like, it was a, you know, very small little thing. It'd be like, $150, $200 or something. And it's kind of a, especially back 10, 12 years ago, it was kind of a running joke, because that was always the first luxury item that anyone ever got. And now that's really the iPhone. And the thing is, it's not like someone's coming in with an iPhone above it, and the iPhone's going to get tired as a brand. I mean, the thing with, like, Louis Vuitton kind of got oversold, right? And, like, people almost got sick of it because it was such a big thing to get. Like, and so now it moved up, you got to get a, like, Hermes or Chanel or whatever, even though they're significantly more expensive. What's coming in above the iPhone? You're not going to replace the iPhone with a cheaper product. That doesn't make any sense. And so it's kind of had this exclusive hold on the status part of the phone market, and that's not going anywhere.
You got to get that blinged out Vertu phone if you really want to, you know.
Well, that's
up.
The thing. But I mean, you look like an idiot. you don't look like an idiot when you buy a Chanel phone.
Where was it? There was a Vertu store, and it was in Vegas.
Yeah, Vegas had a couple.
It's weird.
Oh, they're in every airport in Asia, so I always love checking them out. Yeah, they're. I mean, they're a hoot. I mean, they're better now because they actually do have like modern versions of Android, as opposed to 2 or 3 years ago, and they're still running like Symbian. So they're actually like functional and usable now. Still ridiculous.
They're luxury mobile phones with exquisite materials and cutting-edge technology.
They should hire you for all their ads, you
know? I don't think so. Signature for Bentley. I've got a Bentley phone. Yeah, sure, it's running Symbian, but so what?
Yikes.
As technologists, you know, we mock this, but I think that's the point here. This isn't about the best technology.
No.
Even with the iPhone, it's about status. And what's the status object?
But it's also very clearly aiming at a segment of the market that is the top So it's not the 1%, it's the 10%. And Apple doesn't want.
Right.
Apple doesn't want buyers who are price sensitive. They don't want buyers who are going to, that's an overgeneralization, but they, you know, they're basically, their offering for the price sensitive buyer is you can have our phone from 2 years ago at a discount. But the one that's being offered today, the new one, comes at a premium. And yes, that $400 absolute premium might not seem like a lot,
right?
If you're in the top 10% of the Chinese economy, or of the United States economy for that matter. But if you're in the remaining 90% of the economy, particularly if you're in the bottom 50% of the economy, then you're going to be thinking very long and hard about those absolute amounts, because those do matter.
Why does Apple still why do they have the five, whatever, what is it, the cheap one, the free one now? Is it the five?
They don't want to make crappy cheap phones, in their opinion.
So they want to offer something at that price point? What do they even care?
Yeah,
well, Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Ben.
Well, I'll just say, actually, one of the pieces of news that I found most interesting, I haven't read it yet, I think I'm going to try to cover it this week, but is the discontinuation of the 5C.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, much as people want to protest, I think the 5C was a failure. And the reason it was a failure, though, is very interesting. And the reason it was a failure is because it looked at first sight like it was a cheaper iPhone.
Right.
And the difference is when you go buy a 5S today,
it looks like a real phone.
Pull that out and put it on the table, you don't know if you just happens to be your 2-year-old phone or your 1-year-old phone or the one you just bought. It's still, yes, certainly. It's ideal from a status perspective to have the most current model. And, you know, I'll get a glorify in the, I ordered one in the US and get shipped over and I'll have it a few weeks from when Taiwan does and I can flaunt it on the subway and go out of status or something. But you either have an iPhone, like, I think I just use an Apple tagline, but you either have an iPhone or you don't. And the thing with the 5C is the 5C was never really an iPhone for this specific angle of things, because it was from day one, not the flagship iPhone. And so I think it's interesting that it was discontinued. I thought they might keep it and try to really drive down prices with that model specifically. But I think they've decided, and probably rightly so, that this value of status is worth more than whatever incremental new customers we could get by having, say, a $350 phone, which is interesting. You could certainly see both arguments for it.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was an experiment. Here we are. I'm glad they tried it.
Half an hour into the conversation, we haven't mentioned specs. We haven't mentioned features. And that's kind of how Apple wants it, really. You're right. You either have an iPhone or you don't. Period. Let's take a break. I do want to talk about what I think was a revolutionary new product. And we could talk about this 3D Touch, rebranded Force Touch, whether it works or not. You guys have played with it. You can tell me. Apple TV, a lot of stuff still to come. Maybe even we'll squeeze in a Google story or a Twitter story if I can find one. I don't know. Android Pay launched. I don't know. What does it mean? And why was Microsoft on the stage at the Apple event? Shades of Bill Gates towering over Steve Jobs. But first, let's talk about wealth. And Wealthfront. Many of you, of course, I hope, are saving for your future, whether it's to buy a house, to retire. How are you investing your money for the long term? I'm not talking about your short-term trades. I'm talking about the money you're putting aside. You don't want to put it in a savings account. You want it to grow. But do you have the time to manage it? Are you going to pay an advisor to management? Traditional advisors charge huge fees. We're talking 1% to 3% of the money you have under management. Not to mention the additional fees for transactions and, you know, I mean, just it starts to add up. And every one of those things is just eating away at your savings. Wealthfront is so cool. It's a new way to do it. You don't have to worry about it. Put your investments on autopilot. It's done programmatically. Wealthfront makes it easy and affordable for anyone to access world-class long-term investment management using solid principles. You could start with as little as $500 right now. And here's the best part. 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points. And there are never any commissions. There are no hidden fees. We're no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. It's really an amazing system. The Wealthfront team includes some of the smartest thinkers about Wall Street, including the authors of two seminal books. I remember reading as a younger man, Burton Malkiel's amazing Random Walk Down Wall Street, Charles Ellis's Winning the Loser Games, the Loser's Game. These are guys who have understand how Wall Street works, understand the mistakes that normal people make, and they've built this into the sophisticated software that runs Wealthfront. Wealthfront is completely transparent. You will view your accounts, all of them, in one place, whether it's personal, joint, or retirement. And yes, you can have all three. You'll see every trade they make on your behalf right there in the dashboard, or you can use their mobile app. And they're using sophisticated strategies that are very difficult for others to do. Things like tax loss harvesting and direct indexing that maximize after-tax returns. They lower your tax bill, increase your returns. No wonder Wealthfront has grown 20 times in the past 2 years. They're 20 times bigger, now $2.6 billion in client assets. That number was 2.4 in the copy I'm reading here, and now I see on the website it's 2.6 billion. They're growing fast. It's incredible. I want you to try it. Go to wealthfront.com/twit. Get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll answer some questions about your time frame, your risk tolerance, things like that. They'll show you what their investment portfolio would look like for you. You'll see the allocations they recommend, and that's yours for free. And for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, and again, it starts at $500. That's the minimum investment. You can go all the way up to $15,000, and there's no fee at all. Zero. After that, 0.25%. It's very, very smart. This is technology making a huge difference. Go to Wealthfront, wealthfront.com/twit. Get your personalized portfolio. Read up on it. Don't just take my word for it. But once you understand what they're doing, I think you'll be very impressed. It's people like us, it's the geeks who get it. Wealthfront.com/twit. For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. What a great show. I've been looking forward to this all week. I didn't get to talk during the event, so I have all these ideas churning in my mind, and I thought, who better than Ed Bott from ZDNet, Renee Ritchie from iamore.com, and Stratechery's brilliant analyst, Ben Thompson, all talking about what's going on. And I think whether you're an iPhone, whether you're an iOS, iPhone, Android user, that's not the point. This is the technology industry, one of the real movers in the industry. And this isn't, you know, I look at these events and I think, God, I wish they wouldn't say all these superlatives, the best ever. It sounds too much like a marketing event. And so I think it's really important for us as analysts to kind of burn off the marketing hype, because that's just bogus, and really try to understand what Apple's doing. And I think we couldn't have a better team for doing that. Now, I thought we'd have a little battle between Ed Bott and Ben Thompson right now. And Renee, you know Brazilian jiu-jitsu, so if you want to just throw in, you can tag and get in there.
Ben worked at Microsoft and Apple. He's the swing vote here.
Yeah.
Well,
so if we're talking about Surface versus iPad.
Exactly. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Ed Bott, but I'm looking here, and especially at that crappy keyboard, and thinking, this is a Surface clone, the iPad Pro. Do you feel that way, Ed?
Not really.
I was really hoping I could
just tee him up, Neil.
No, you know, because if you go back to the original iPad launch, I'm pretty certain that they showed a keyboard case for it in like the first 20. Steve Jobs showed a keyboard case
really?
For that. 20 minutes.
Keyboard stand.
They had a stand, and then it was meant to be the Apple keyboard. But yeah, no, it's spot on. And they also demoed it. The demo apps were Pages and Keynote. Yeah. So
typing,
broadly speaking, yeah, that's exactly
they
right.
They thought that the original iPad was going to be kind of a netbook killer.
How interesting.
And it turned out to be more of a, and you know, the, and the joke at the time was that people said the iPad is just going to be a big iPhone that doesn't make phone calls. As it turned out, that was completely true, and it was a good thing for Apple, and it was a good thing for people who bought the original iPads because that's exactly what they wanted. So now they're sort of, you know, with the volume of iPad shipments going down, I think they're sort of looking at the overall brand and the overall value proposition of iPad and saying there are a lot of people who use this as a laptop replacement. I spend a lot of time, Ben, you spend a lot of time in airports. I spend a lot of time in airports. Renee, you do too. We see a lot of people with iPads
yes.
tucked into these weird, ugly keyboard cases. They're trying to do things with them. And so I think Apple is just responding to the market here. And now, to me, the disconnect with the iPad Pro is not that it's a Surface clone, but that they're trying to appeal in terms of size and screen quality to creative professionals. But creative professionals want full Photoshop. They want full Final Cut Pro. They want full Premiere. And the limited capabilities of the apps in the iPad Pro are going to be the limiting factor for it in terms of acceptance, at least in the first year, I think.
I almost wish they hadn't released the keyboard because I think that muddies the waters. I think really the iPad Pro, it's all about the pencil and the screen.
I think that's exactly right, Leo.
Go ahead,
Renee. No, I'll go last.
Okay, so Renee, and then you, Ben. And I'm going to shut up.
My background is in design. I worked for 10 years in design using Wacom tablets almost every day. And I grew up in Photoshop. Photoshop is still muscle memory for me. And I actually like the way that the iPad Pro worked with the pencil a lot. It is absolutely the best stylus I have ever used, way better than any Wacom tablet I've ever used because the response rate is great. They're actually doing predictive algorithms that you can watch sometimes self-correct. They stay up with you. You can scribble. You can cross-hatch. The tilting is fantastic. I tried Procreate, Photoshop is never really known who it's for. Like previously it was for photographers. Now they're trying to make it for UI designers. And I've always used things like Fractal Design Painter and Illustrator and just different tools for the right job. And that's what the iPad kind of felt like when I looked at the different 3D apps and the different drawing apps. It really looked like you could purpose build something that was really good. Now I am a Final Cut Pro user and I don't know how that's going to translate to iMovie, even with three simultaneous 4K streams or whatever, because I don't know how I'll be able to cut and do things as precisely as I want. But when I get one, I'll give it a try. But I think for a lot of people, I've wanted to buy a Surface just to sit there and draw with it because Apple didn't offer that functionality. But there was nothing else about it that I was really going to use. Now I have that built into an iPad. And conversely, there are exactly those people that Ed's been talking about who are using keyboards. And Apple, because of the MacBook, has gotten really good at making super low profile keyboards. And I tried it out for a while, and it feels like using a MacBook keyboard. So if that's who you want, if you are that productivity person or the creative person, they've sort of got the tool that fits whatever you want to do.
Well, I disagree about the keyboard. I thought the keyboard was terrible.
Do you like the MacBook keyboard?
I thought it was much worse than the MacBook keyboard, which was I've only used it in briefly. But I definitely think the Surface keyboard is better. And for the record, the way it plugs into the side of the iPad and does power back forth. I mean, that's what the Surface did. Absolutely.
That's pogo pins, Apple style.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that said, I have a few points I would make. First off, I do reject that it's a Surface ripoff because the Surface is a PC with a touch layer that you can use. And the iPad is a touch OS from the ground up that you can put a keyboard on and type on. And if that sounds trivial, I think that it's trivial in a very fundamental way in that we talked before about the consumer market being different than the business market. The consumer market is driven much more by the user experience. And the user experience has to be optimal, I think, for you to be successful. And by extension, I think this sort of hybrid mashup approach is not the optimal one. I know some people like the Surface. I'm not a fan. The reason I'm not a fan is because I think Windows is a PC operating system, and I think a PC mouse and keyboard driven operating system, the form factor of a laptop is just better. It's more flexible. It you can do more with it. How many people do you see using a Surface without the keyboard? Not barely anyone. And I think that's a shortcoming. On the other hand, Leo, I think you're exactly right. I think there's these two accessories signify two different potential futures and markets for the iPad. The keyboard is the iPad as a PC replacement. And yeah, in some respects, it's better. It's simpler. It's easier. The App Store and theoretically that sort of stuff. In other respects, it's worse. I think the form factor is worse. And I think that the power and capability is worse. On the other hand, this pencil thing, you nailed it on the head. It's really good. It's as opposed to the Surface or a Wacom tablet or any other thing that uses a digitizer, you don't have that big gap between the where you're drawing and the actual screen where you get this weird parallax effect when you're actually using it. And the responsive rate is incredible. Like it's by far the best that I've ever seen.
It looks incredible in the video. I mean,
it's by far the killer feature of the thing. And to me, what's so exciting about this is I don't use my iPad for anything but for one app, and that's paper. By 53, which I create illustrations for my blog.
That's how you do those napkin illustrations?
Yeah, no, exactly. And basically I buy an iPad because there's one thing I can do on the iPad through 53 that I can't do on a PC. I can't do on a phone. Like, and that is what the pencil I hope leads to is more of these sorts of applications that can only be done on an iPad or alternatively, maybe on a $2,000 Wacom tablet connected to a PC, which is arguably going to be an inferior experience anyway. And I'm much more excited about the pencil future than I am about the keyboard future.
My initial reaction, I'm watching this announcement, first of all, shocked that Apple led with it. I mean, there was the watchOS stuff, but then really the big first piece of hardware. And it shocked me when Tim Cook said, all right, let's talk iPad. It was like, really? But looking at it, I felt like we were seeing a paradigm shift in computing. I think this is really important. This is the move from desktop keyboard and mouse computing to touch first computing. And I think it, and you make an excellent point in your article, by the way. In fact, the title says it all, from products to platforms. The iPad is no longer a product. This is, if Apple does this right, a new platform. But you say, and I think you're exactly right, that Apple's got to adjust its App Store policies if it's going to make this work. It's going to come down to software. Now, I didn't get to play with it, but I'm really gathering from those who did, from you guys and others, that you look at something like iMovie or GarageBand, Apple apps, and it is not just, any more than the iPad was a blown-up iPhone, it's not just a bigger iPad. Something happens when you get to that size that it is a natural UI for certain categories of applications. It's a much more natural way to work. And if appropriate applications are developed for this platform, it will really have us rethinking the way we use computers. Before the show, and we probably should make a special out of it, we had Etty on, who is the Evy, right? The developer of something called UMake. Phil Schiller showed it on the screen during the keynote at umake.xyz. This app isn't out yet. He won't say, but apparently they've been working with Apple because this is very much what Apple wants for the iPad Pro. They're going
to
release
it. It's terrific.
Yeah, they're going to release. Yeah, I was playing with it. It's a 3D design program that you use the pencil and your fingers to design stuff. He actually showed me a car that's already been designed with this as beta testers. So to me, I feel like the iPad Pro is nothing less than a new form of computing. Is that going too far?
The interface is different too. It's not just a blown up iPad Air either because of size classes. Now you can actually expose more interface on the iPad Pro than you can even on the iPad Air. So you can have, you know, extra palettes. It's almost like the 5K iMac. You can have extra stuff there so you don't lose the usable area. You just gain utility. And that was super impressive.
It underscores to me the mistake that was Windows 8 and is continuing with Windows 10. Microsoft misunderstood what people wanted to use Windows for. That's a desktop OS. Trying to shoehorn touch into that is not the solution. And it's the same reason why OS X shouldn't have touch stuck in there. Apple now has two separate platforms, and I think this is a maturation of iOS that was, some to me anyway, somewhat unexpected and very exciting.
The super interesting thing here, Leo, is the way that Apple's doing this. They have essentially, like, you can quibble about how much OS X is like iOS, but on the other products, you have backboard and frontboard, and then you have that on the iPhone with Springboard, you have that on the watch with Carousel, you have that on the Apple TV with Pineboard and Headboard, and now they're starting to differentiate the iPad. I still want them to go full out and make a completely unique version of Springboard just for the iPad, but they're doing things like split screen and slide over, and they're letting it be its own thing. And if you logically extend that towards the future, I think you're absolutely right. As much as the MacBook is sort of closer to an iPad than a Mac, this is sort of closer to what you traditionally use as a computer than an iPad before. And I think there is a very interesting space for them to explore there.
Evie said, this is like Minority Report. You know, we're all thinking about gesture-based computing. Forget that. It's very natural. You've got a screen. You touch the screen. You use the pencil. You're intimately connected with the stuff that you're doing. But, Ben, you make an interesting point. I mean, really, whether this happens or not depends a lot on what Apple does, especially with the App Store.
Yeah, well, I think that to your point, Leo, this was already to a degree possible on the iPad as it was. But I think your point is well made that especially for these creative sort of applications and, you know, the whole thing that is frustrating with the whole creation versus consumption debate is that creation was so often like presumed to be just text input. Whereas the iPad, what's exciting about the iPad is arguably it's a superior input device for everything but text input.
Right.
Of its adaptability to any sort of, you know, it's not just the touch aspect, but also it becomes the appropriate interface, you know, to whatever it should be.
I tell students, buy a Chromebook. Don't buy an iPad. Schools are crazy to buy iPads because what students do is type.
Yeah, I'm a huge Chromebook fan. I think, you know, the Chromebook plus iPhone combination is probably the best for the majority of people out there.
But there's a huge category of new applications. This is the that compares traditional CAD software with using UMake to do the same kind of design thing. And I think after you use this kind of thing for a while, you might say, hey, that mouse and keyboard, that's the crappiest
way. Did you see Adobe, Leo? I used to use InDesign every day, and the speed with which they did a layout on a page on the iPad Pro was amazing to me. Draw the box, make a big X in it, suddenly that's a graphic holder. Make a box, put two lines in it, suddenly that's a text column.
When you make a platform, though, you're really dependent on independent software vendors.
Look how quickly and easily we can enhance bad stereotypes.
It's also, I mean, we must not forget, first of all, the size and weight of this device is intimidating for a lot of people.
You're not going to put this in your purse.
And the cost is intimidating for a lot of people. Yes, it's less than a BMW.
Well, it's less than a workstation, too. I mean, you're selling this to people who use workstations. This is not.
Yeah, but it's not a workstation. It has some very nice graphics in it. But it only has 4 gigabytes of RAM in it. And as my colleague Jason Perlow at ZDNet wrote a very interesting article published, I think, today or last night, saying basically laying out the case for this. And it really requires a lot of cloud power on the back end for a device like this to do its work. There was a demo that they showed. Because a lot of the things that they're showing off demand a whole bunch of data to be processed, and their 4 gigabytes of RAM is not a lot of workspace. Most creative professionals are working on machines that have 32 gigabytes of RAM on it, not 4.
Yeah, because they're using heavyweight operating systems that do. Well,
it's not just the operating system; it's the size of the files. It's the size of the transforms that you're doing. This is a very interesting device, but it's very early, and in some ways, it's a piece of glass with very nice responsive capabilities that needs some serious processing power on the back end to really do its magic. You're not going to be looking at raw X-rays on this thing all by itself.
You know, we were at the meetup. We had a great meetup, by the way. Thanks to everybody who came up on Wednesday at New York City's Rattle and Hum Bar, which is so much fun. You've been there, Ed, I'm sure, with Mary Jo Foley.
I have.
It's so great. But a guy came up. He said, I'm a neurosurgeon. And he said, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to make it because I've got 8 patients that I'm monitoring right now. He had, what was he using? Was he using an iPad or was he using a laptop? he was using a laptop, but I could see him doing this on an iPad Pro. He's monitoring 8 different patients at different hospitals. I guess this stuff, radiology, this has happened. It's been outsourced now to groups.
And drinking while he's monitoring 8 patients?
I said, aren't you worried? He said, nah, it's only one guy now, and I think he's going to be okay. I don't know exactly how this works or what he's doing, but he's got these graphs and these things, and he's looking at them. While he's having a beer. So
they showed that on the watch, Leo. They showed during the demo. They showed heart rate monitoring on the watch.
This was a little more sophisticated than that. I mean, these guys are hooked up to a lot of stuff. They've had neurosurgery, I guess, and they're being monitored after the fact. I'm not sure what he's doing. The point being that I agree with you, Ed. I think your colleague and you are exactly right. You need some – but isn't this the era of the cloud? I don't think
there's also local. Like I often will just pick up my iPad continuity up a document, work on it with fingers because that feels more natural to me, and then go back to my Mac continuity it up again and continue when I want to use the mouse or the bigger storage. And I think we're getting to a world where Google's definitely made the cloud more seamless, and I think Apple is making moving between devices more seamless as well.
So I think there's lots of good and points that are kind of not necessarily. So one,
fix this up, Ben. Well, rewrite us, edit us here.
Edit is exactly right that it is expensive, and the iPad is at a very kind of fundamental perspective more expensive than the phone. Put it this way: the $500 iPad is more expensive than the $650 iPhone, and the reason it's more expensive is because the iPad is an and purchase. You're going to buy a phone regardless, right? So Leo, you had that Moto in your hand, right? It was $400.
Yeah.
So in that world, the iPhone is not a $650 phone. It's a $250 phone. I mean, because you're paying a $250 premium to have an iPhone. In the case of an iPad, you don't necessarily need to have a tablet. So every dollar that the iPad costs is a dollar that you're electing to pay. And in that respect, the iPad is always a harder sale than the iPhone is. That said, I would disagree with you, Adam, that the cloud capability is an issue. I think that's the way computing is going. And quite frankly, Microsoft is a big leader in this respect, where that makes sense, where you have the local processing handles, the local UI, and you have that sort of interface. And that was kind of what the old the Netgear, like that they were doing, where you would have the pure terminal on one end. Thin clients, yeah. That's what they got wrong, right? They didn't have enough. The user experience wasn't good enough because they put too much in the cloud. But I think a hybrid approach. I'm not objecting to that. What I think the key thing though that Ed did hit on with this being expensive is that the iPad is, and even more so today than it ever was, especially with iPhones getting bigger and more capable, it is a niche device, and it will always be a niche device. And
right.
Given that, I don't object to Apple releasing a more expensive, more souped up, more powerful version, because that's exactly how you should respond to being in a niche market. There's two kind of big strategies. One is a general purpose market, widespread, where you want to reach as many people as possible, make it up in volume. The other one is the niche market, where your goal is not volume. Your goal is maximizing revenue per consumer or per buyer. And the iPad Pro does that. If you're someone who actually uses an iPad for things that can only be done on an iPad Pro is better. It's more expensive, all of which is a good thing for everyone involved. And the issue, the worry, the concern for the iPad from my perspective is that the app makers for iPad are also going to be niche providers. And a niche provider, like I said, needs to maximize the revenue per consumer. And that's the exact thing that the App Store does not currently allow. The App Store is all about being a volume play. It's not about maximizing revenue per your consumer over time. And that's the big concern, is Apple doesn't have the business model, I think, to support the sort of apps that will make the iPad Pro a super powerful and compelling device and to reach the potential that you laid out, Leo.
Sure, surely they could flip a switch and say, well, we're going to have trials. We're going to have, I mean, can't they make that work?
It's not a question of trials. It's a question of, these are apps, the amount of work and the amount of development effort that needs to go into these powerful apps that need to run for a limited market of people. Those apps need to be sold at $200, $300, right. $400 each, not $5 each.
Yep.
I mean, and they could be, but it's an expectation thing, right? I mean,
and the technology is pushing them in the wrong direction. Like Apple really wants universal apps because that's, you know, it looks like an iPhone app, but that's also what's filling up the slide over and what's filling up the very right. slim version of SideView. And when you make that and you make a universal app, charge $50 on the iPad Pro, but like do you artificially restrict it against the iPhone because people aren't going to pay $50 for an iPhone app? They've set up an incredible, not just Apple. We've decided we don't want to pay for things. Apple's decided they don't want to increase the value of the platform, and developers have often raced to the bottom. And we've got the sum of all these compromises right now. And I agree 100% with Ben.
Well, the thing is this, I don't think any of you made that, but I'm going to pretend like you did so I can push back against it. I push back against the contention
that
a lot of people do state, and particularly in the Apple developer community, that this is inevitable because we're in a world, and I've contributed to this. I wrote an article a couple of years ago explaining how software by definition has zero marginal value, which means undifferentiated software will eventually cost $0 because especially in a very competitive environment like the iPhone. And that's true, but the key word there is undifferentiated. Like if it was always the case that highly replicable content with zero marginal cost could not be charged for, then I'd be screwed. Like I sell text on the internet. It's like the most competitive environment in the history of humanity. But it works because some number of people find it to be worth paying for. And the challenge for an app maker is that there is no way to articulate your value. And because if you go in the app store and there's an app that costs $100 or $500 or $5,000, by the way, the app store of women, it's $9.99, you can't demonstrate your value to consumers absent them buying it and like contacting you separately for a refund and then doing this weird like it's a total mess. And this is why I think things right. like trials are actually super important, because they're a way for differentiated apps to demonstrate their differentiation and to drive purchase. And so that fixes the revenue per consumer angle, because now you can get more per customer. And this is way more important than Apple taking 30% or things like that that people focus on. The 30% of a dollar isn't very important. Like the big issue is that top line number. How much can you drive? And that's why, and this is something that Microsoft understands. And this is, I've made the joke that the iPad would arguably be better if Microsoft owned it, because Microsoft is a platform company. They get that. They understand what developers need. They understand how to create the environment for developers to make money. And Microsoft, like one of the key things, yeah, every time you go to a Microsoft developer conference, like they have a huge one every year, their sales conference or whatever, they always show the slide that shows the value of the total Windows ecosystem and how much Microsoft harvests. And they brag about the fact that, oh, of the total value of the Windows ecosystem, we keep 24% or 27% of it. And their point there is that we're invested in making a big pie for everyone. Mm-hmm. We're not out to get all the money for ourselves. And Apple does the exact opposite. Apple is this pure, like hardcore, like we're going to commoditize our compliments. It means all the parts that we don't make money on, we're going to make them as cheap as possible. And in the short run, that works. And it works on the iPhone. And it works on the iPhone because the iPhone, the most important apps are social networks or communication networks or things that where we keep in touch. And those
games
have to be free. This is the games point is interesting, because games started out as it was an okay market. What set fire to the games market was Apple, one, enabling in-app purchases, and then two, enabling in-app purchase for consumables, which is where you can buy the same thing over and over again. and that where you can buy, you know, 10 points or whatever. And that is what led to the games explosion on the iPhone, because it's not enough to just have all this amazing graphics capability. You also have to have a reason to invest the money to take advantage of that capability, which means you have to have a business model that supports it. The iPhone and iOS does have that business model for games, and it has a thriving games ecosystem as a result. The concern here is for other apps, for productivity type apps, especially ones that don't have a service component. If you have a service component, you can charge a subscription, and that kind of makes sense. But if you have a self-contained app, there's no way, one, to demonstrate your value to get more money, and two, because there's no upgrade pricing and no way to communicate with your current customers, you can't extract more money of your same customers over time. It's always easier to get money from the same customers than it is to find new ones. And that capability is just not simple at all on iOS. And Apple could unlock this, but I just feel they're such a product-focused company. And that's to their benefit. That's why they have a platform in the first place. again, in the consumer market, you win with a great product. You get a great product, and then you have the right to be a platform. That's Microsoft's problem. They don't have the product to become a platform in the consumer market. They don't have the enterprise leverage anymore that they used to have. And so Microsoft's sitting on the side, this great platform company that doesn't have a platform. And Apple's on this side, this great product company that has a platform they don't seem to know what to do with. And it's frustrating because it's not like these developers will go to another tablet. There is no other tablet with customers with a demonstrated willingness to pay. Apple owns all those customers. And there's all this class of apps, Leo. You're so excited about the future of computing. So am I. But I'm also worried it's going to never happen because the business conditions were never in place. Sorry,
what I'd really like to see is from Apple is a vice president of App Store that's sort of analogous to what Angela Ahrens mm-hmm. is for retail, mm-hmm. and that's someone whose only job it is to wake up in the morning and decide how to make the App Store a tremendous product, as good a product as an iPhone or an iPad. Because right now, App Store is bifurcated or even trifurcated. You have Craig Federighi's org who makes all the frameworks. You have Phil Schiller's org which does app review and evangelism. You have Eddie Q's org which does store management and editorial and runs the actual store. And without one person sort of making that a fantastic product. You just have again the same thing where people aren't always on the same page, and it shows. Like Ben's favorite app, Paper, they stopped charging money to make money off the pencil. Now Apple is making a pencil, and what are they going to make money on? And I love that app too, and I want that app to be here. I want to give developers money. I just want better ways of doing it.
Ed Bott, isn't this kind of a problem that Microsoft solved with its unified app store and one Windows solution? Isn't that what they're addressing? Or is Microsoft going to have the same problem?
I think in a way, both Apple and Microsoft are converging on the same point from different directions.
Yeah.
Microsoft's historical strength has been understanding price-sensitive, efficiency-sensitive business customers. Apple's historical strength has been understanding non-price sensitive, very quality sensitive consumers. So they're both trying to aim towards a point. Microsoft trying to get some traction in the consumer space, which they're getting maybe a little better at, but not too. And Apple trying, but only half-heartedly, I think, to get into the business and enterprise space, because they realize that the margins there and the sell cycles are so long and so difficult that they almost, I think, want to concede that market and say, we're going to be happy playing in the high end here where the margins are high, and we'll leave the enterprise to Microsoft. It's almost like it creates a world where sometime in the future, Microsoft and Apple merge just to sort of create the Venn diagram
that has those two
customers working properly.
I feel like Microsoft solved this, though, somewhat with Office 365. This is a really good example of a way they've monetized what was a huge cash cow, their number two product, by charging a subscription fee, and you get it free if you've paid that subscription free on the iPad. And then, in fact, they have a very nice touch-first version of the Office apps. Works quite well on the iPad. I think will probably work even better on the iPad Pro. But they get their money from that monthly subscription fee.
But it's almost unique. Office is historically it's a legacy product that has survived and thrived. And there are very, very, very few things that you can put into the same class as it. Adobe has been trying to do the same thing with its Creative Cloud products.
Adobe's been very successful. And it's actually one of the more, I think, underreported, underappreciated stories, way that Adobe
I'm happy to pay for my Creative Cloud model. Subscription. We have a number of them here. We have the high-end subscriptions for the editors. I just have the photography one. $10 a month. I get a Photoshop and Lightroom. That's a great deal for me. And I imagine I will get a free Lightroom app, maybe even a free Touch First Photoshop app on the iPad Pro as a result.
The difference, though, and I think Ed is driving at that, is a big reason why Adobe and Microsoft are able to pull this off is because they already have the established mindshare. And
exactly.
Adobe said you're switching to Creative Cloud whether you like it or not. And basically everyone is so locked into Photoshop that they had no choice but to go against it. And there was a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth and things like that. And if you're a new developer, particularly on the iPad, the whole lure of the iPad, Leo, is that you can make an app on the iPad that you can't make anywhere else. Right. That's the potential.
Right.
And why, like, it's harder to explain to consumers why you should pay a subscription fee for an app that's limited to one device. Like the whole...
So there's no desktop market for that kind of thing.
Use it on the web, use it on your thing, all that sort of stuff.
And, how about cloud services? Can you charge for that?
Well, I mean, yes, you can. So two things. One, yes, you can. And but two, a lot of apps don't necessarily have a natural service component. Like Paper, for example, they are building a cloud service. And they're building a cloud service, as far as I can tell, primarily to monetize, not because the app actually needs a cloud service. but the thing that frustrates me about this argument is that it's not that you guys are wrong. There are ways to monetize. The issue is I would like to stop with the let's figure out how to overcome Apple's limitations and let's dwell on Apple's limitations and stop making excuses for them and finding ways around them. The fact of the matter is there's no reason for Apple to not support stuff like this beyond, as far as I can tell, and this is what was so ironic about Microsoft and Adobe being on stage, the fact that Apple never again wants to be held captive to an app developer. You go back to 1997, Macworld Boston, and Steve Jobs having to stand on stage and talk about, you know, Microsoft investing in the company and that they'll keep Office on there. The fact of the matter is at that point in time, Office mattered more to Mac users than the Mac did, and so did Photoshop. And Jobs never forgot that. Right. Jobs was right about the Flash stuff.
Everything that happened since then was Apple's attempt. Never again. They said never again are we going to be beholden to Adobe.
No, exactly. Or any app developer. And I'm convinced, and I wrote this several years ago, that Apple, so much of Apple's behavior on developers is driven by this, never again. And you think about it. Like with Paper, they've done it without actually having a business model. But I care more about Paper than I do the iPad, and that's why I buy an iPad. And so Apple's hesitancy is like you can at least theoretically understand it. But the problem is they're going to spite their nose to
cut off their nose to spite their face.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think you've pinpointed a real structural issue. Apple's built a company to do one thing, and for the true success of the iPad Pro, it needs to do something completely antithetical to them.
But Apple is not one, like one of the things, and you know, Ben knows this better than anybody, Apple is not one thing, and there's these big discussions that go on inside Apple too. And you can look back at the original App Store and you see code. They had accidental pop-ups that came up that showed you that upgrading and other things had been built into, or at least tested as part of the system. And they've tested a whole bunch of stuff over the years. They just haven't flipped... I don't want to say it's not as easy as flipping a switch, but they haven't gone in that direction.
Well, I like your idea. You need a czar. You need an app store czar who has some power.
Because some people, like you can see this, that there are people at Apple who believe for right or wrong that there's absolute user experience advantages to keeping things incredibly simple so you never have to worry about upgrading, never have to worry about trials. What if you just buy the app and you all you need it for is a minute and then you've taken all the value out of it? Or what if you buy it and you create data in that app and then that app goes away and your data's still in it? How does the person, because you didn't decide to buy it, so what happens to your data? Like, there are a little bit of questions that go around this, and their answer to them so far has been to keep it dead, stupid, simple. And that might not scale going forward, and they need to have someone whose job it is to fight for that discussion.
What you really realize is how deucedly difficult this is and why it is so hard for a company and technology to stay relevant year in, year out.
Brilliant companies.
Microsoft has to deal with this. Google has to deal with this. Apple has to deal with this. And I'm so glad we've got some smart people to explain this all to me because it's starting to sink in. Ben Thompson from Stratechery.com. So good to have you. Ed Bott from ZDNet. Always a pleasure.
Trying to get Lucy into the shot.
Lucy's the best.
Lucy's trying to. There she is.
Hey, yay. Lucy. There is now a new tradition on Twitter of showing your dog. You got to show your dog. Next, you have to go out in your garden, Ed, and give us a tour of your vegetables.
Ah, the basil has almost been completely harvested for the season.
High tech, high touch. Also from imore.com, Renee, Richie, we're having a lot of fun. This is a great show. We'll keep talking as long as you'll keep listening. But first, a word from Braintree. Are you a mobile developer? You know that if you're taking payments, payments is one of the most important things to do, one of the easiest things to do wrong. I mean, we're not just talking about security. We're talking about your user experience. 70% of mobile carts are abandoned before the buy button. And that's a lot of money you're leaving on the table. So check out what companies like Uber do. I mean, don't they have it down? Don't they make it easy to take that Uber? You don't even have to think about it. You get out of the car, you're done. There's no button to push. Uber uses Braintree. So does Lyft. So does Airbnb. So does Hotel Tonight. So does GitHub. So does StubHub. I love Braintree. Braintree is making it easier and easier for mobile app developers to do one of the most important things, get paid without having to suffer through the coding of this. 10 lines of code. They make the payment experience seamless. And something like Uber, it feels magical. And now you can add that experience to your app, too. And by the way, take every kind of payment. I mean, not just Apple Pay, but PayPal, credit cards, Bitcoin, Venmo. And Braintree has great support. In fact, if you don't have the time to do the integration, they can do it for you. They've payouts are fast. It's a secure, I mean, really secure platform. That's important to your customers. They're ready to grow your company from your first dollar to your billionth dollar. They've done it before. They could do it for you. Many a unicorn uses Braintree. Braintree, a full stack payment solution waiting for you right now at BraintreePayments.com/twit. Show the boss, show the product manager. If you're the product manager, show your engineers. I think you'll reach agreement very quickly. This is the way to do it. I just did a rental with Silvercar. Braintree made it so easy. It just changes your life. It's so great. BraintreePayments.com/twit. And by the way, if you sign up and you use that URL, BraintreePayments.com/twit, we're going to get you your first $50,000 in transactions 100% fee-free. Fee-free. BraintreePayments.com/twit. If you tuned in to hear about anything besides Apple today, good luck. Good luck. I'm really excited by the iPad Pro, but you've now kind of depressed me. It sounds like this is going to be kind of an intractable problem. Here you have a platform that could revolutionize computing, and you have a company that has kind of a built-in business model that's antithetical to it. Is there a solution, Ben?
The thing to remember is, and I when Apple showed iOS 8 last year, like, everyone was like overjoyed because finally they're opening up, right? They're allowing more internet communication, like all sorts of new capabilities, more access to the system.
Yeah, how did that work out?
Well, the problem is that they didn't have the business model to match. They haven't opened up the business model. The good news is that, one, it shows that Apple can fundamentally change their approach, because they did from an API and engineering perspective. Two, we've seen, at least in the history of the App Store with the in-app purchase stuff, that we have seen the way that a change in policy can totally give birth to a new segment. And we just need to put those two things together to have these new business models for apps. And it's not just the trial stuff, although, I mean, Apple, like, if you want to do the subscription stuff on Apple's, like, institutional support, if you want to sell, like, on a per seat basis, also very poor. The reality is like, just the, unless you have an internal enterprise app store, it's actually very hard to sell to multiple consumers. You want to sell to a school, for example. And so I think the point about having someone focused on this on a holistic level is a really good and important one. There's no one on Apple's executive team that is focused on developers. And then two, I mean, the App Store policy is in one of the, it's in Phil Schiller's org, which is one of the more, there's been less new blood than in some of the other orgs, particularly in engineering. And I think there's probably more of the old school Apple mindset of, we're going to control it. We're going to control everything. We're not going to be held hostage by anyone. We're going to make it super simple for consumers, and that's it. And I think that I wonder if there needs to be more of a change.
Right.
Kind of some new blood approach. I think it's like, I don't think it's going to be impossible forever. Exactly. I mean, I think we need the Craig Federighi of App Store policy.
It's really telling. I mean, Apple was famous for its developer relations in the early days. When it was OS, you know, System 7 and OS 9, I mean, that's where Guy Kawasaki made his bones. It was developer relations were very, very important to Apple. It's really telling that there's nobody at the top level of the executive team that's even thinking about that.
Well, those are different branches too, Devrel and...
There's so many. I mean, the App Store is doing great from a top line perspective. The revenue numbers are huge.
There's no incentive to do that.
There's no warning signs. There's no red flags from executive. They are coming, but the problem is almost all that money is coming from games and also subscription services like Netflix and stuff like that. Yeah. And so if you're Tim Cook and you have 40 gazillion things on your plate and all you see from the App Store is that it keeps going up and to the right. Like
there's no incentive.
How is this going to ever break through? Right. To me, the big signifier of the App Store is iPad revenue, which I think there's just no reason to buy an iPad. I think that's because there aren't enough of the compelling apps that make it a must buy. But we're getting into kind of a very convoluted chain of cause and effect. That's, I will admit, hard to prove. And I might be wrong about this. I don't think I am, obviously. But I can appreciate why this hasn't broken through to the higher levels of Apple.
Hey, things change.
But here, let me just... So one of the things was Apple needs a czar for the App Store. Well, no, they need a business model for the App Store that expands beyond what it is.
Enriching Apple.
And Ben, you were there during this time period. This is... Microsoft's unwillingness to cannibalize its own Windows business to build the future eventually wound up costing it. And this is the same dilemma that Apple finds itself in, 180 degrees the opposite direction, their unwillingness to cannibalize their highly successful consumer app store business in order to make it palatable to businesses and enterprises. It's the same exact thing. No matter how much you talk about the willingness to be able to disrupt your own business to see the future, you may be intellectually willing to make that happen, but when you have to deal with quarterly results that where every product line that you're selling is bringing in multiple billions of dollars or tens of billions of dollars per quarter, you don't cannibalize that. And that's what you don't need a czar. You need an executioner who's going to come in there and basically say this business has to change because in 3 years the spigot is going to stop flowing.
Steve Jobs could do it. He did do it many times. You don't have anybody like that anymore.
Well, but if you look at what happened to Apple recently when they did the reorganization, Craig Federighi, he was not just at Mac OS 10 anymore. He went to iOS as well. So development now, more or less, there is like the watch in the car and stuff like that. But more or less, Craig Federighi is running across the product line. Johnny Ive is running across the product line. And there's more. Angel Ahrens is now online and in-store retail. They combine those two things. That hasn't happened with App Store. You still have app. I think store managers, like people whose job it is to sell stuff on the store, I think they would love a lot of the things that we're all talking about. But people who are, and not developer relations, because developer relations and evangelism and review are separate organizations, all under Phil Schiller, but separate. There are the ability to go across those orgs and make things happen. I think the czar is the guy, you know, I don't know if he's an executioner per se, but I think the czar is the guy who goes in and makes all that happen. The VP who does have that cross company power to enact positive change.
Let's talk
about... I think Ed does make a really interesting point, though, that all the App Store policies are very well tuned for a widespread consumer market, and they're well tuned for the iPhone, frankly. The sort of apps that succeed on the iPhone are well supported by the current App Store. And I talked about before the distinction between a niche business model where you're maximizing revenue per customer and a scale business model where you're maximizing the number of customers. It's very hard to support both or to kind of wrap your head around both. And the exact thing we're talking about is, I mean, even the free-to-play games, that's still a scale model because the whole way they work is you get the games to as many people as possible and you get like 1% of them to give you a ton of money. That's where you
make all
your money from. Yeah, exactly. And so yes, and the iPhone is a scale play. And you got to remember the iPhone is like 60% of Apple's revenue, like, or in profits. It's just a huge part of the company. And that more than anything is the thing with the iPad. I mean, it is a niche product, and it's going to always be a niche product from Apple's perspective. And all the changes we're making are primarily to benefit, or proposing are primarily to benefit the iPad. And that's, I guess that's a reason to be concerned and frustrated, and to appreciate why it doesn't seem they think it's a problem, even though these things just seem like such low hanging fruit.
I love CR1 in our chat room showing his erudition, quoting Upton Sinclair. It's difficult to make a man understand something when his paycheck depends on his not understanding.
Right.
We'll give that.
Success hides problems, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about Apple TV. It's changing the face of television. The future of television, says Apple. It looks pretty clear that they held on to it for at least 6 months, if not longer, waiting, hoping to make deals with networks to provide it, turn it into an over-the-top set-top box. They weren't able to make those deals. They finally did release it. What is Apple? Renee, give us the lowdown on Apple TV. This was a hobby for Apple. It's still a hobby, as far as I can tell. Is this important to Apple's overall plans?
Well, it's important in that traditionally the Apple TV, like the Apple Watch, enhances the overall Apple ecosystem. So if you have an iPhone and an Apple Watch, an iPhone and an Apple TV, you get greater value than just having the iPhone by itself. The Apple TV and the Apple Watch aren't really devices unto themselves yet. Maybe the Apple TV will get there. But you're getting a really small... Apple TV was originally this really small version of OS X with a big hard drive, and it didn't really go anywhere, and you had to sync over all your content. And then with the second Apple TV, it became an iOS device that just streamed everything, and they've been building on that. So now you have a box that's based on iOS 9, has an Apple A8 processor. It runs Metal, which is Apple's version of OpenGL or DirectX, and it runs apps now. You have an app store, and those apps are different binaries than they are for the phone or the iPad, but you can sell them on the app store in bundles. So you can be playing your game, you get home, your game just keeps playing on your television. And there's going to be apps for Netflix that can do more than just what the JSON frameworks allowed them to do in the original Apple TVs. They'll be able to be full-on apps and offer a ton more features. And you have like the natural language interface with Siri, which does the sequential inference thing, but they've really tuned it well for the television. So you can say, show me comedies, show me only new comedies, show me the episode of Twit where Ben Thompson is a guest star, and it knows how to process all that. Go back. I missed what they said. It
you knows know, that's my favorite it. Feature because I'm old. What did they just say?
Well, it goes back and then it shows you the subtitles too to make sure you
love that.
Not hear it. It's fantastic. And it does all these little clever things, and it has a new remote with touch.
I'm going
to
buy
it
just for that.
Buttons.
What is the syntax? It's,
For show Ben Thompson on Twit?
No, I know that one. They showed what I want. Show me all James Bond movies. Now show me James Bond movies. You don't even say James Bond movies again.
What did she say?
Now,
what did he say?
So what did she say? What did he say? That's the syntax?
Yeah.
And it shows you closed captioning for that 15 seconds?
Yes.
Sold.
Every old guy like us in the university.
I say that every night. What? Lisa does too. What? We rewind.
And then when you say it, you miss something else. So it's horrible.
We rewind so much. Okay, good. And by the way, skip ahead 7 minutes, which advertisers are not going to like too much.
Well, I mean, they're not famous for having advertising-based content on.
Actually, you're right.
Netflix or iTunes.
Do you think that was a problem with making deals with CBS and the locals?
There's so many layers. But for the developer side, this runs like it's a version of UIKit, the same stuff that runs on the iPhone and iOS. They hit a bunch of stuff to make it much simpler. But if you know how to develop those apps, you know how to develop Apple TV apps now. And if you have a popular app, you can bring it over. So there's a lot of advantages.
Will it be an open app store? In other words, if I develop a Twit app, I obviously have to go through the approval process. But have they said anything about that? Are they going to be fairly democratic about that?
I guess it depends on whether it makes sense or not for a television. They only showed off entertainment, home shopping, and games so far.
I think the app store will be relatively open, but to get into the universal search, that is controlled.
Yeah, I understand that, and I wouldn't expect that, frankly. Although
Universal search is actually really clever. They have this idea that a developer might make a mistake and put private data as public data. So when they get it, they just hash it, and then they wait till many people access it in the app to make sure, one, that it really is public and it's popular, and then they start surfacing that. So you get an absolutely assured public information, but the most popular version of that public information as well.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the where you can search across shows. So if you want to find a certain episode or show, it's showing on Hulu, showing whatever.
Yeah.
But that there gets, I mean, it does not include Amazon Prime Video.
Amazon doesn't include iTunes either, so it's fair. In fact, the Amazon search on the...
So we have fragmentation in the extreme.
Insane fragmentation.
In television now. And as far as I'm concerned, while Apple TV is a lovely device, and I can imagine it being successful in some living rooms, it feels like an accessory to me, in the same way that Apple Watch feels like an accessory. You have to be invested in one of the major high-cost, high-value components of the Apple ecosystem, either a MacBook or an iPad, or maybe one of the high-priced iPhones, and then you start to see the value of the watch and the TV. But well, wait a minute.
Can I use Apple TV without having any other Apple device at all?
Yeah, but it's not as valuable. I mean, the value, yeah.
Well, as long as I could say, what did he say, and skip ahead 7 minutes.
Yep. No, all of that is totally independent.
The federated search. So what? So this is, by the way, Fire TV had the same problem. It was searched, but not everything. Seemed to really favor Amazon. Ben, what do you know? Is Apple going to not allow search across some platforms?
So you have to get into universal search. So that's a separate.
Well, that makes sense because you'd have to have a database that they could read, and that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, the big hole is they don't have Amazon Prime Video, and it doesn't seem.
Well, they don't have YouTube. Did they put YouTube?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they got Amazon Prime Video
and YouTube.
It suits their business models, both of them.
Well, one would think,
but it's a non-starter until it does. I agree with
you. That stuff is going to be a heck of a negotiation. I wish I could listen to that negotiation.
Almost anybody who's a cord cutter or just wants these kinds of capabilities has more than one box. They have a Roku and an Apple TV. I have everything. Shield.
And again, Leo, I hate saying this, but...
I have an Xbox One.
I have that too, and I love the Xbox One.
And I have a Comcast cable subscription. And between the two of those, I have more entertainment than I need. And I'm in the demographic that will pay large amounts of money for video content. And the upcoming demographic, the demo, the one that, you know, all the advertisers want here, isn't willing to pay hardly anything.
No, they watch YouTube on their iPhone.
Well, they seem to be willing to pay for Netflix and Hulu. I mean, that's something like 22% of it's a pretty significant number of the range, which is much higher than willingness to pay for lots of other categories. But I think the bigger issue, which I thought you were going to say, Ed, is the usage for younger generations. They're primarily watching these services on iPhones or on iPads or on their computer. Yes. The actual usage of there's going to be a bifurcation between the viewing of TV content and the usage of the TV set. And the amount of time spent watching TV has remained super consistent for ages. It's a huge deal that it decreased by a couple minutes over like this last year, which is like the first time it's ever decreased at all. But even then, it's still been very, very
large.
And
if you include screen time, it's probably going up. I mean, total screen time, right?
Well, no. The issue, though, is just the TV set in general. In the very long run, I think is only ever going to be an accessory. It's going to be much less the center of things. And I think for young people in particular, having their own screen is a big deal. And it's
that screen. And you share that screen with people. You don't have it's not a communal experience. It's a shared, here, look at my screen. Here's what's on my phone. Look at my phone. Here's what's on my laptop. Look at my laptop. It's not, I mean, the idea of a big screen in a living room is, first of all, the idea that you have a living room is alien to a younger generation. And the idea that you then have content that's coming exclusively to that big screen and that everyone sees at the same time is also alien, and that will seem very quaint, like rotary dial phones in about 10 years.
But I wonder if how much, because right now we've had a discontinuous experience, and I wonder, like, because continuity and extensibility and all these things are playing huge into Apple's current plans. You're playing a game on your iPhone. You come home, no one else is using the TV. You're just playing it on the Apple TV. It's a continuous experience. We used to complain that, oh, I have Angry Birds on one device. I can't even pick up my iPad and play it. And you're going to be able to pick up on one device, play on another. So I think the lines are going to blur. And to the previous point, I'm going to keep saying this, Leo, Amazon Prime still isn't in Canada, so it doesn't matter to me if it's on the box or not. I mean, I don't know how many channels you get.
If you only got Amazon Prime, you'd know.
I know, but I mean, like, they're the international services are there. The ones that most of the, like, I think it's 100 countries or something really care about are on that box. And I'm sorry the U.S. doesn't have all of them, but I mean,
can I just tell you,
it's going to be a great box.
Apple knows exactly why people are going to buy an Apple TV, even at the increased price of $150 or $200, because they showed the things that sell it for me. I just mentioned, what did he say? And skip ahead 7 minutes. Crossy Road multiplayer sold. The Major
Holy
League
crap,
Baseball.
Leo, they're selling Apple TV for old people.
Wait a minute. Major League Baseball? You like Major League Baseball? That was an amazing demo. Two games going on. You flip back and forth.
Snell and
right, but
like
here's
that.
The thing. A lot of people focus on that demo, and it was an amazing demo, and it shows why software is better than this linear sort of stream. What they didn't tell you about the demo is that you can only use the Major League Baseball app for games that are, one, not on national TV, and two, not in your home market.
So I'm going to be watching a lot of Toronto Blue Jays games. I'm excited.
You could watch all the Yankees games you want.
Right.
And so if you're a Yankees fan, it's great.
No, that's
except
a limit.
For
but that's Major League
TV.
Baseball. That's them. That's their blackout stuff. That's
and that's for
it.
Now.
It's not. It's them and it's every other sports league, because the fact of the matter is the value and economics that come from bundling are so much greater than an over the top service for leagues, and that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future. And so, yes, it's kind of a similar thing to the iPad thing. You can have the technology in place, but if you don't have
the
business model in place, then it doesn't matter. And so I think for some people, like if you're a Yankees fan not living in New York, like that MLB app and Apple TV looks freaking fantastic. But you're that's not everyone. I think it is going to be more of a niche product, and a big part of it is the business part has to come through. And I think people in tech have been predicting the end of cable and linear TV for like going on like 40 years now. And that's before cable even existed, which shows how in-depth this sort of argument is. And yes, it is fracturing. And the reason it's fracturing is because the jobs we ask TV to do are getting narrower and narrower. But that doesn't mean that tomorrow, next year, we're going to be watching NFL football games with our NFL app on Apple TV, because the economics just aren't there. And until they're there, it's going to be a niche device, leaving aside the fact that I'm not sure how much young people are even using big TVs anyway.
Actually, my kids will watch YouTube on the big TV, which is really strange. But there is a communal aspect. Don't forget that these people under 25s are maybe the most communal generation ever. They do everything. They date in groups.
Sure, but that's only a fraction of your TV usage. And so I'm not saying TVs are going away, but it's like people will still want private cars. I just think in the future they're more likely to rent them than to own them. Like, which you can get to the Apple car question. Like, so I think
like
that
Uber for television.
None of this stuff is necessarily going away, but I think yes. I'm just going to stop there.
Uber for television. What would that be? I can't even. Ed, you're right, though. You know, the Xbox One with that NFL app on the side there with the stats and the fantasy stuff. That's cool. That's nice. That's actually a well-done app.
It's very, and nobody knows
about it.
And nobody knows about it. And what we have actually in TV now is a situation where we don't have dominant. In every other platform, you have one or two dominant manufacturers. You know, in smartphones, it's Apple and Android, and nobody else matters. In the TV set-top box space, you either get what your provider gives you, or you have an incredible assortment of fractionalized,
exactly.
Randomized. Mm-hmm. Boxes.
You should. I can't. Lisa says, "Oh, good. Let's watch Ray Donovan. I said, well, we can't watch Ray Donovan in the living room. We can only watch Ray Donovan in my den because the device that recorded Ray Donovan, it's crazy.
I had to explain that to Judy the other day. I'm sorry, we can't watch this movie on the big screen TV because it's not on a service. It's on the Xbox One.
It's crazy.
And so I'll have to pull it up on the laptop or the tablet and Miracast it or Chromecast it to the TV. And I said, and I feel sorry. We're about to go on some really fun international travels, and we're going to have house sitters here. And I have to write.
Oh dear.
A damn manual.
Oh dear.
I have to actually write a manual for our house sitters on how to work the TV. And I'm tempted to just say, tempted to just unplug it and throw a blanket
bring
over
your
it.
iPad.
Where are they from?
Well, one's from our house sitters. One's from Seattle.
Okay. Because I say if they come from Germany or something, you just say turn to channel 3 and you're good.
the issue is that the differentiation in TV is driven by the content. It's not driven by the device, and this is why the App Store is potentially the most interesting part of the Apple TV is because the App Store. If that becomes a differentiator, that gives Apple more control and more leverage with the content providers. Right now, the content providers are the ones that have all the leverage. And it's the same thing in music, I'd add as well. Like in music, it's the labels that have all the leverage, which is why from a pricing and content perspective, the Apple Music isn't differentiated.
It's not differentiated, yeah.
You can look at it compared to iTunes. What made iTunes the juggernaut that it was piracy. And what I mean by that is the labels were so scared of piracy, they were willing to do a deal with Apple.
Right.
Today, streaming killed piracy, which means the labels are in some respects stronger than they've ever been. So Apple gets no special favors. And if you have the same thing in video where if the content provides a differentiation, that means there's not going to be a dominant player. Like the in a stack, in whatever industry might be, there's one layer that matters. And that layer and everything else, it's going to be commoditized.
Is Chromecast the solution? Chromecast really is interesting. As long as apps have Chromecast support built in, you can use any device to just cast it to your TV.
I love the Chromecast.
I think that's a very kind of clever way around this.
No one in this sector is going to become dominant unless someone gets leverage.
And nobody's so going to get leverage because... Right.
And you know, even as simple as you and I think that Chromecast is or Miracast, every Windows 10 device supports Miracast, and my Android phone supports Miracast as well. You've got all those things in there, but ordinary people just their eyes glaze over when they try to imagine the idea that there's something they're watching on their phone or a tablet or something, and then they have to go through a series of... If it's more than one click to make it appear on the TV, it's not going to happen. And it's still the barriers to entry are too high. There's a reason that Google made the price of the Chromecast $35 or whatever it was, because they wanted to seed it into the technically sophisticated audience. But I don't think that ordinary people are going to be able to manage this complexity. We still have the problem is still complexity,
right?
And complexity is being driven by business models and ridiculous global copyright laws.
Well, and it's also not reliable enough. Like if it fails once or twice, they just stop trying, and all of them fail on you enough that most people just will never touch it again.
Well, the issue is
how do normal people live? I don't understand.
Simpler, better lives, Leo.
Everyone is focused on this complexity issue, but that is second. There's two aspects of complexity. There's UI complexity, and everyone's like, oh, well, I can't wait for the cable box to die because the UI is complex. The problem is that is a second-order concern. The first-order concern is, can I find the stuff that I want complexity? And the cable box still wins here. And the complexity that you guys are driving at is, do I look at it at Apple TV? Do I look at it on Amazon Fire? Do I look at it? Like, where do I find it? That is a different sort of complexity that Apple TV has yet to solve. And the UI can be as beautiful and as intuitive and as fun to use as it could be until it solves that first order level of complexity. Because what matters is the content. That's what I mean by that being the differentiated layer. It's going to have trouble breaking through in competition to something that has all the content, even if it's got this convoluted remote in this ugly grid on the TV screen.
Is there a genetic difference between people? Because I can sit down at any television multimedia setup, see the remotes, look at what's there and go, okay, yeah, I can do this. And then there's other people.
Yeah, but we can't do what they do, Leo. It's like a vocabulary.
What do they do that's so great?
It could be medicine or mechanical engineering, or they could take a car apart, put it back. I mean, everyone has aptitudes.
But I guarantee everyone on this panel and probably everyone listening doesn't need a manual to figure out how to watch TV. It's obvious. You just put it on HDMI 1. If doesn't, and then you got to get the turn on the Xbox One and the Roku.
They will
Xbox.
Throw that controller at your and head you, so fast.
But we are the 1% or even the 0.1% in terms of technology, and that is a real problem. The problem is the conceptual layer that goes on top of this. If I can, I spend a lot of my time as an instructor. I write books.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. I write books and manuals and articles that explain to people how to do things. And the hard part is not the step one, step two, step three. The hard part is the conceptual layer.
Yes.
Where you explain to someone how this thing works so that when the steps that I just wrote about stop working because Microsoft or Apple or Google came out with an update in 2 months that breaks that step-by-step regime that I talked about, if they understand the conceptual thing that I explained, they can get through it very easily. But those conceptual layers, I agonize over them.
I gotta share this tweet because I think it captures it perfectly. Steven Sandoff just tweeted me on Twitter. Says people are literally willing to flip aimlessly through channels to find what they're looking for as long as they know it's on somewhere. But that's what's so smart about that is the key is that they know it's there.
And yeah, but if it's 500 channels, they're never going to find it.
They absolutely will. The challenge for an Apple TV is if you can't turn on the Apple TV and know that what you want to watch is on there, and you have this additional layer, I want to watch X, which thing do I use? Like the UI doesn't matter if you have this issue of you don't even know if what you want. This uncertainty. There. Uncertainty is even worse than a bad UI.
I just looked it up in my Evernote a note how to turn on the Den TV, because I figured I'm going to be sending this text out. Turn on the TV with this small silver remote, then choose cable sat from the Onkyo remote, then make sure the Xbox is turned on by pressing the Xbox button on the game controller, then choose TV on the Xbox. Sometimes the TV turns off, so if the screen goes dark, turn it back on with a little silver remote, then use the Xfinity remote to choose 702. That was to watch one thing once.
My version has PDFs with screenshots of the remote with all of the buttons labeled.
And by the way, this is out of date now because if you use the silver remote to try to turn the TV back on, it's going to turn the Onkyo off because of CEC. So now, let's take a break.
I mean, to Ben's point, like consistency is absolutely a user feature. And if you don't know it's going to be there, you're gonna doubt that it's be there. And then it just affects your whole
I think
usage
it's
pattern.
Worse than that. I really do. I think it's a mess, but we'll figure it out. So, and that's why you end up watching The Sopranos instead of The Wire. Like you wanted to. When we come back, we're going to talk about the things Apple left out. Some very big things that Apple left out of the keynote. Renee Ritchie is here from iMore.com. Ben Thompson for Stratechery. Ed Bott from ZDNet. I got the three smartest people in the world here. We're getting down to it.
You could run an Apple keynote like that, Leo.
I feel like this stuff is like chess or something. I mean, it's worse. It's like a Rubik's Cube mixed with 3D chess, and you make one move, and then 3 years later, oh, crap, we screwed up the business model, and the whole thing falls apart. It's I don't know how anybody survives in this world. It's gotten too complex, and that's why I'm going to move to a farm. Are you buying the new iPad, the new Apple phone? Maybe you want to find somewhere to put your old one. Can I make a suggestion? Gazelle. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E. Gazelle. Gazelle makes it easy to buy and to sell. So let's talk about selling first. That's how Gazelle got famous. You can trade in your old devices. Get a price that's locked in so you know what you're going to get and you have 30 days to decide. They will buy even broken iPads and iPhones. Of course, they buy other devices like BlackBerries and Samsung Galaxies. They'll buy Surface tablets, Google tablets. If you go to gazelle.com, you'll see, look, what? $335 for my 6 Plus, $375 flaw. That's awesome. Now, here's the deal. You've got 30 days to pull the trigger on that. You don't have to. There's no obligation. The only obligation is from Gazelle to you that they'll give you that price. Once you decide, okay, I'm going to take advantage of this, you check out. They send you a box, prepaid postage. You pay postage on anything worth more than a buck. You pile that box in. Put a lot of stuff in there. You've got old gadgets that are just gathering dust. That's crazy. That's like saying, oh, here's a $100 bill. I'm just going to leave it in the drawer. That's crazy. Send it there. If you forget to wipe the personal information or you can't because the device is broken, they'll do that for you. And then they turn it around and they give you your money very fast. You can get a check in the mail. You can get a direct deposit for PayPal in your PayPal account. That's really fast. Or for an extra 5%, use the Amazon gift card. If you buy a lot of stuff on Amazon, that's a great deal. Gazelle's paid out well over $200 million to over a million customers. And now they buy and sell. So the best stuff that comes into Gazelle will be sold. You can buy certified pre-owned. When I say certified, I mean it. They have this very elaborate 30-point quality inspection on every device they sell. Make sure everything not only functions totally perfectly exactly right, but that the screen doesn't have scratches on it. There's no defects, things like that. You can get their various quality. You can get it at like new. That's going to cost a little more. If you want to save a little more, and this is what I do for my kids when they lose their phone, I get the slightly used. It's kind of, you know, slight signs of wear, but again, 100% functional. 30-day return means you're guaranteed that it's going to work. You have 30 days to return it. No risk to you. I just really love Gazelle. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E. To buy, to sell. Remember, gazelle.com. Actually, this is a good time to buy last year's iPhone at Gazelle and get a great deal. Save a lot of money if you're worried about that. All right, we're going to get back to the conversation. Lots more to talk about with our great panel. But first, if you missed this week on Twit, you missed a lot. Take a look.
Previously on Twit.
Hey there, Mike. I can tell you I'm here at the Ed Sullivan Theater, and the anticipation for the new iPhones and the new Apple TV is just monumental. I'm not recognizing most members of the press here because it means that Tim Cook has more time for me.
Tech news today.
iOS 9 will become available next week, but a new feature has shown up in the beta. You can train Siri to respond to your voice and nobody else's. Siri's version of this feature will prevent something that actually happened today in a White House press briefing.
Is the president upset that he couldn't get even one Republican
Mac Break Weekly.
So, Christina, I have my my purse right here, and I carry my iPad in it. Am I going to be able to do that with a 12-inch iPad Pro?
If you can fit the new MacBook in your purse, then you might be okay. But realistically speaking, probably not.
Before you buy.
The Moto X really appeals to me for a couple of reasons. One is it's a very pure version of Android. This will be Lollipop 5.1.1. When they do add stuff, they add stuff that's really useful. You'll be able to put the phone to your ear and speak to Google Now, and it will respond only through the speaker.
Twit, great tech news and analysis every day.
Coming up this week, Dreamforce, which is Salesforce's big annual event, kicks off on Tuesday, September 15th in San Francisco. Apple's iOS 9 and watchOS 2 will become available to the public on Wednesday, September 16th. And the TechCrunch Disrupt Hackathon begins on Saturday, September 19th in San Francisco. For all this and the rest of the news this week, tune in to Tech News Today at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC. At twit.tv/live. Back to you, Leo.
We're talking high tech. We're really talking Apple today. There's a lot of Apple information from the week. There's been other news, too. Twitter. I'll just say the words. Google. Facebook. They're all involved. You maybe can clarify for this for me, Renee. I'm very confused. Somebody in the chat room is saying, oh, you can't store apps on the Apple TV. They use on-demand resources. Serenity Caldwell wrote a good article explaining this. Are Apple TV apps limited to 200 megabytes? That doesn't sound like much.
No, so what happens is they don't have giant hard drives in them, so they have limited NAND flash storage. So what happens is you have a 200 megabyte initial download. That could be something as simple as a splash screen. It's whatever they want. It's designed so that if the device is full, it doesn't give you this big error message that says, sorry, you're out of room, please go delete something, because they don't want you to have to do file system management on the Apple TV. So what it will do is download that 200 megabytes, which will almost always fit in, and then download a payload of up to 2 gigabytes immediately if there's no storage pressure. Otherwise, it'll start removing resources from other apps as it downloads that to sort of intelligently balance what's on the device.
So I might want to play a game like Crossy Road and I have to wait till it downloads because it's...
Well, you'd have to wait till it downloads anyway. So what this does
Well,
this is the same thing. So in your example, if you downloaded like Infinity Gauntlet or something and you didn't play it in 3 months and then you downloaded Crossy Roads, it would start removing the oldest played levels from the Infinity Gauntlet game, the ones you'd already passed and haven't played in a long time, to make room for the very first Crossy Roads levels. And then as you played more, it'll download more and more levels and get rid of older ones. So it's trying to intelligently balance all the space, sort of like iCloud Photo Library or iCloud Music, where it wants to keep everything nearline so you have a much bigger capacity. It's Ed's cloud point again. You have a much bigger capacity than you have on the lower device, on the local device.
So they sell two versions. They sell one for $150 that has, what, 16 gigs?
I think it's 32 and 64.
32 and 64. And then the $200 for does it even matter then? Should I just get the little one?
You'll be able to keep much more local content available. So it'll have to do less of the load balancing.
All right. Well, I remember all the hell Microsoft went through with Xbox, the original Xbox One announcement, about always on and checking the home office. And it's funny, Apple just, nobody cares.
Well, they're not doing anything other than, so when you make an app, you just, the developer tags, like this is the initial download.
Right.
These are the levels. Like it might be like video tutorials. Once you've watched the onboarding thing, you don't need to store that 4 gigabyte video anymore or that cutscene anymore. So it just dumps them. And then if you ever decide, yes, I really want to watch that again, it'll go download it for you.
One thing they didn't mention, which kind of shocked me, is HomeKit. I thought the new Apple TV was all about HomeKit, the home automation.
They moved that to iCloud. Initially, the Apple TV was a remote access point. So if you were at the airport, wanted to switch off your lights, you could do that. Now that happens through iCloud. So it doesn't have to do anything on the Apple TV anymore.
Oh, so that's that.
Yeah, some people have got older home automation equipment and they were hoping that Apple would do something where the Apple TV would magically make all the old things like our Hue light bulbs, Leo, work with HomeKit without having to go buy a new Hue hub.
Right.
But then it still wouldn't be secure, and then Hue hasn't made the lights work with anybody's hub by themselves. So that's a sort of a fantasy at this point.
Google seems to have the same fantasy. The on-hub router really seems to be less of a router and more of a home automation hub.
It will, but it's still, for example, unless Hue enables their lights to work with it, it's not going to work with it. So there's a lot that has to happen on both the vendor's side and on the platform owner's side for that to work. You have to essentially make every light bulb its own tiny hub instead of just having that one Hue hub that connects all the light bulbs.
I'm increasingly of the opinion that nobody's ever going to get home automation working, and it's just a...
We'll get there.
Really?
We're optimists, Leo. We're optimists.
We're doing stupid things like Hue lights and my doorbell with a camera on it, but nothing talks to anything.
Leo, your great grandchildren are going to live in this amazing world.
No, they're not. They're not going to be able to watch TV. They're not going to be able to do anything.
No, you're in the trough of depression, which is like the adoption curve, which is there's a ton of hype at the beginning and it goes up. Yeah. And then it way overshoots the capability.
Right.
And then I was like, this sucks. It's never going to happen. It's never come through.
That's where I am now.
The technology just keeps increasing, increasing. And then eventually the expectations match up with what's actually there. And you realize, what's the great Bill Gates quote? Like, you will always overestimate what can be done in a year and drastically underestimate what can be done in 10. Yeah. And that applies to a great many things. I would imagine this is one of them.
And there's the other thing, Leo, is there's no 4K story. And yes, 4K is not many people own 4K sets yet. There's not a lot of 4K content yet, but the new Apple TV does not support 4K.
Yeah, and while there was some speculation that maybe the hardware could, they just turn it on with the software switch, the problem is HDMI 1.4 isn't going to really be a good solution for 4K. It can do it, but only at 30 frames. This is not a 4K device. Do not delude yourself.
And again, like, there's a lot bigger problems to solve. Like, if there becomes an iTunes 4K, how are they going to handle upgrading your content? Like, remember when it went to HD, they offered you the ability to pay to upgrade all that stuff? And
I could shoot 4K on my iPhone, my new iPhone.
Yeah, but then it gives you awesome digital zoom and the ability to crop down to to sample down to awesome 1080p Leo.
Right.
And you have just made my point that the Apple TV is an accessory for people who already are invested in the Apple ecosystem and are willing to upgrade it in a year or two or three and are perfectly happy. If someone's coming into this for the first time, they're going to focus on the limitations. If they're coming into this as a member of the Apple ecosystem already, they're going to focus on the synergies.
Synergies are for sheep.
I had to buy an iPhone 3G just to get GPS, Leo.
Hey, by the way, okay, so I bought the iPhone 6S Plus. I said I would. 128 gigs because I wanted to spend more money. Yeah, I did, and I'm worried now because I think it's pink.
It is pink. But it's an awesome metallic pink, Leo. Andy and I will match.
It is pink. It is really, really, really pink.
It matches my face. It's pink.
It's the new color, Leo. Everyone will know you have the new iPhone.
You're gonna put a case on it anyway.
Everybody puts a case on it. I'm gonna put a case right away. Maybe I'll have a little pink peeking out, but there'll be a little tiny pink frame around the
outside of it.
I'm drinking from a pink water bottle.
Why don't they just call it pink?
Pink phone color. Because rose gold sounds more inspirational.
See, I know rose gold is it because it's a coppery colored gold. I've seen actual rose gold. It's not that color. Rose gold is coppery. This is pink.
Well, the gold iPhone is more champagne than it is actual yellow gold, too. It's goldish. Goldy. It's like chocolatey in a popsicle.
Lisa, this is a geek couple. We're in bed. It's 12:01, midnight. Right, 1 minute after midnight, Saturday morning. We're in bed. She's got her MacBook. She's on Verizon.
Oh, that's a mistake.
No, I was smart. Yeah, I used my iPad. Did the App Store, right?
Yep.
She's done. She beat me, by the way, because the Apple Store opened later, like 12:05 or something.
Oh, she bought through Verizon. Oh, yeah.
She went Verizon right away. She said, got it. She said, what'd you get? I said, rose gold. She said, oh, crap. I didn't think you were going to get rose gold. I got rose gold.
We're rose gold buddies now, Leo, all of us.
Yeah. Are you rose gold,
this
too?
This is like winning.
I bought silver.
This is like the people who think they're winning because they were the last bidder standing in an eBay auction.
So pathetic. I win first. I know. Actually, I was because the only people doing this are us. I'm watching Renee on Twitter. He's watching me on Twitter. What'd you get? Did you get in? What's the best place to go? Is it Verizon? Is it T-Mobile? Did you go right through the App Store on the web, or do you go to the App Store on the iPad or the iPhone? How did you do it? Silly.
You got a much better shipping date. I'm getting mine in October.
What?
Yeah.
Did you get up?
I got it like at 12:03 or something. Oh. I figure I'm playing some sort of Canada tax.
There's your mistake. Day. Yeah. You got to get right up at 12 o'clock. Refresh.
I won't, even though I got the first day shipping date, but I have to have it shipped to me then in Taiwan.
That's kind of funny because they're going to ship it from China to the United States and then back to you in Taiwan.
Yeah, it's annoying because it's going on first day in Hong Kong and China, but in Taiwan is supposedly a part of Apple's Greater China region, but we don't get it first day.
Go ahead.
See, I want the one that comes with iOS 9.2 because those other ones.
The middle finger emoji?
Wait a minute. Don't we get the middle finger emoji right off the bat?
iOS 9.1. No, that's iOS 9.1. Just coming out the beta.
We don't get the burritos and the tacos and the pizza, the hot dogs.
You get the middle finger emoji just for buying it in the first hour, Leo.
I get the privilege of spending $1,050. I win for pink.
That's only $20 a month, Leo.
It's so interesting to watch because, for instance, you would strongly get the impression that Apple invented the middle finger emoji. But in fact, all they're doing is now supporting the full Unicode emoji stack.
It's a big deal because they didn't before. And some people were saying, oh, Apple would never do it. And there was like all our nerd friends, Leo, were blogging about it, saying, I don't care about any other feature in iOS 9. I just want the reverse hand with middle finger extended emoji or the taco or the burrito,
American food. American
food. Still no poutine. I'm just going to say that. Still no poutine. I'm distraught.
No, American food. Forget the poutine. American. Nobody wants poutine. How would you even make poutine in an emoji?
All you do is you hold down on the french fry and it gives you tater tots, poutine, and chips as an option.
I want garlic fries in there because I'm from San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, they sell a million of them.
You're right. That's actually brilliant. And actually, emojis are passe. It's all about stickers now, right? Emojis are too little. They're little bitty things. I want giant stickers.
Hey, stickers are awesome.
I agree.
We need stickers and iMessage.
Which messaging app do you use, Line?
Well, the problem is the killer feature of any messaging app is who else is on it.
Right.
Which means, yeah, I use a ton of them, but it varies by country. I mean, I use Line for everyone in Taiwan, but then I mostly use iMessage with Google Voice's horrendous client for text messaging as a fallback for anyone who doesn't have an iPhone for people in the States.
Good God.
It's sad. It is sad.
I use Telegram because it's got the best set of giant emojis of all kinds.
You sent me Donald Trump. It was awesome.
I sent you Donald Trump. I've got Trump. I've got Taylor Swift emojis. I've got Star. I mean, where else are you going to get a Star Trek emoji?
Wars.
Like
Wars is the word you're looking for. Star Wars.
I know. I do it just to drive.
Do you have Eddie Q in his red shirt sticker?
No. Is there an Eddie Q emoji?
I don't know. There should be. Someone's got to make that.
Damn. With a little folded up cuffs.
Someone needs an Eddie Q and Scott Guthrie emoji, both in their red shirts, side by
product
side.
Red shirts.
Only one makes it to the planet alive.
It's and well, who's got the hair. Who's the hair guy at Microsoft?
Joe Belfiore.
Joe Belfiore has a beautiful, beautiful head of hair for a man.
Yeah. Leo.
I think we've got something here. A spitting set of stickers of great hair guys: Shingy, Joe Belfiore,
Craig Federighi. Air Force One sticker right there.
Love it.
Wow.
I have my own mechanical Leo bot on Telegram, by the way, if you are a Telegram
my
user.
My work is done here.
at Chief Twitbot. Just follow at Chief Twitbot. It's an automatic little bot on Telegram because I have no friends.
I'm filing trademark infringement lawsuits against you left and right, Leo.
He's calling Disney right now.
Oh, man.
Oh, man.
You should see these stickers. Follow me on Telegram. I'll send you a set.
Wait, you said that you had Taylor Swift out loud, Leo? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, but Taylor Swift is perfect for certain. See, stickers are all about communication. And there are times when you need a Taylor Swift emotion, you know, to really put the idea across. I think
this is why Line is so. I mean, part of the thing is because it's Japanese background. The Japanese have always been very good at this.
They understand this.
The character and building, like,
it's in their language. They're ideograms. They understand how picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah, don't get me started on Western conceptions of Chinese characters. But there's actual characters that are consistent, and the level of emotion that can be exhibited in detail and context is really incredible. And
I agree.
People laugh and joke about them, but I think once you get used to using them, it's awesome.
I just sent you, Renee.
I'm a well-known sticker advocate.
Yes. Look at, Renee, I just sent you the opening. Perfect Taylor Swift emoji of shock and surprise. There's
She's
nothing.
Make an open letter, Leo. We're both in a lot of trouble.
You know what's great about this is when you pick an emoji, and then it shows you the stickers you have
that
show that emoji.
How gorgeous is that, Leo?
Wait, show me. Let's see.
I don't even want to know what the one right
the pedo bearer seal of approval. Hey, you got to work hard to get that. And then above that is Big Bang Theory. Yeah.
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 This is frightening me.
Oh man, come on, Ed. Follow me on Telegram. I'll send I'll send you a sticker. The other good thing about Telegram is if you don't have that sticker, you just click on it and you can add it.
Yeah.
So they're viral. They propagate like disease.
And they just want people using their stickers because one day they'll figure out how to charge for them.
No. You know what? It's an open platform. You could. These are just.
I know. I couldn't resist the Bill Gates China.
I know. Look at the. By the way, the iPad Pro is going to be the best Fallout shelter platform ever.
The games are terrific. I tried a bunch of them. They were really, really nice.
Can't wait. Well, I was excited about getting the first iPad because for Words with Friends, it was so hard to do on a little 4-inch iPhone, 3.5-inch iPhone.
Those tiles are huge now, Leo.
They're big.
Yeah.
Rich experience.
So you don't need your reading glasses.
Yeah, we're definitely getting the in what respect does Apple's new products appeal to old men angle on this?
Oh, well, I'm an old man.
Let me get my rose-colored glasses so I can actually hear it.
I'm sorry. Rick Perry gave me these glasses.
Hello there, Ed. How are you feeling about the new living glasses. Images that'll be part of your iPhone? Harry Potter-like animated images.
Wow, you know, it's like nobody ever did those it's before. Like,
I think Nokia did it before anybody did.
1812. Jeez, Nokia did it in 1812.
1812. The HTC Zoes are similar to these. The idea is what? That the camera, as soon as you point it at something, for a second or two, it's just recording already. Then you take the 1.5
picture. 1.5 seconds.
And then it records another 1.5 seconds. And then what?
Well, it's not recording. So it's taking still images and then animating them. They were really careful to say it's not video. It's actual still images. And it kind of doesn't look like video. It looks like still images being played as fast as possible.
It's an animated GIF.
Yeah, basically. Although I think it's in their core UI format. I don't think it's in
the I'm sure it's also it's pronounced
GIF.
Never mind.
The G is silent.
It's GIF.
It's pronounced if. Throat Warbler Mangrove. It's GIF. There's only a handful of people who will get
actually,
that
no,
joke.
I think they're JPEG. I think they're JPEG.
People just laughed out
Throat on. Warbler Mangrove. I got it because I'm an old man.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is compatible with Facebook. Can I post my Harry Potter?
You can send it to older iPhones, and you can do a long press because there's no force press on the older iPhones. Do a long press, and it'll animate. But so far, I've only seen it on Apple's platforms. The Watch stuff did animate on other platforms, though, so maybe they will.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that, but the 3D, we haven't talked about the iPhone at all, which is interesting.
Isn't it?
The 3D touch, though, is really good. It's super easy to use.
I did want to ask you about that because I have to say I was very skeptical. Force touch on the watch is not intuitive and kind of I'm not sure what's going to happen. It's even worse on the laptops because it's not consistent and you can't really tell. But everybody who tried it on the phone said this 3D touch actually works.
Yeah. I think part of it is on the laptop you don't have the immediate feedback. You don't have the direct feedback to your finger.
You need the haptic feedback, yeah.
Well, it's not just the haptic. It's that you're not touching the item. Like the abstraction of the touchpad makes it much more difficult to pull off. I think the thing that's most impressive, though, compared to the watch in particular, is that it always works on the phone. Like it works every time. And what I think Apple is doing that's smart about it, I think Apple's always been good about this, and something that in contrast to, say, Microsoft, for example, is that they're keeping all of the, at least for now, and they hope they continue doing that, all the 3D touch interactions are just ways to do actions faster that you could do in traditional ways. And so because the issue is it's kind of a hidden feature.
But are you going to know, is it intuitive? Are you going to know what it's going to do and kind of get it?
It seems
pretty consistent, especially when it comes to like peaking and stuff like that.
Right.
But the point of the matter is, if you don't know how to do it, it won't change the way you use the phone at all.
Right.
But if you do know how to do it, it makes certain aspects.
It speeds things up.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think I was relatively skeptical as well, but I was probably more. I was very, very impressed in actually using it in hand.
Yeah.
This is back to that conceptual point of view. Once you learn how it works, you can extend it to other things.
Right.
You learn it in one place.
Right.
It works in other places. That has been historically Apple's strength in terms of user interface design. They may not be first. They may not be best, but they are certainly most consistent.
Well, I liken it to give Microsoft credit, right-click. The contextual menu that popped up with right-click was very quickly adopted by people. People got it right away, and it was very much of a power tool. Well, you couldn't do it on a Mac because there was only one button.
What Microsoft got wrong about right-click was there were things that you had to use right-click for.
Yes.
And that was actually very difficult for especially novice users.
Because they couldn't find it.
Actually, I think the Mac did right-click better was because it was always optional. In part, it was forced because there was never two buttons on the laptops and stuff. But that meant that anything you put in right-click – it also had to be visible elsewhere in the UI. So if you didn't know how to do right click, you could still access it. And I think this is a really critical point in UI. And something that the watch is a problem for the watch is when critical aspects of the UI are hidden, it's a big problem. And that's the case for the watch. And
it was the same problem for Windows 8. Non-intuitive user interface.
Well, it was a huge problem. So when one thing that was kind of shocking to us when it first launched was for a Windows 8 app, you needed to swipe down on the top or bottom of the screen, and that would actually bring in the controls. It was kind of frightening, the number of people that launched Windows 8 app and never once swiped the top or bottom. Like, there was just no...
What's the charms bar?
No affordance.
Where's the charms bar? Yeah, affordance,
that's exactly it.
Yeah. Well, good. There,
really, the word intuitive, it's a hot button.
Well, we've learned. We thought the remote control was intuitive in our home theater.
Right. No, there's no such thing as intuitive. There is, can you learn it quickly?
Right.
If you can learn the concept quickly and extend the concept to other things. That was the same thing with right click.
Right
click wasn't mandatory ever. It was a way to quickly get to features that you otherwise had to go find menus for.
That was the
benefit of it.
Interesting thing here is that, I mean, they've been working on this for years, and they've been doing a lot of hardware work, a lot of interface work. And the idea is you have a single column view on the iPhone, which is very different than on a computer with multi-windows or an iPad even with a split view. And it just wasn't fast. Click that email, go to the next screen, wrong email, go back. Or now the phones are bigger. And we talked about this a long time ago, Leo, but like you can solve for one-handed ease of use in other ways than just having a small screen. And this is sort of the confluence of this, where they've done a lot of work on making sure that the clicks, and you can adjust the click, the 3D touch in settings. You can turn it off if you have, for example, physical impediments to using it. But if you don't, they've done a very good job of making it so you press a little bit and you get a hint. It's almost like the head shaking animation that tells you what if there is something there, and if there's not, that sort of motion will open things in other apps. So you start to discover it a little bit. Then you push a little bit and it gives you the preview, which is called peek. You press a little bit more and it commits to bring it full screen, which is called the pop. And it has a lot, like you can force swipe to go right to the multitasking interface. So there's a back button now in iOS 9 for inside an app, and there's the force swipe to go back through the app stack. You can force, 3D touch the keyboard to switch it to the trackpad, like on the iPad on iOS 9. There's a whole bunch of things that they just made super, super fast by virtue of implementing this thing. And what makes me, what I find so cool about this is back in iOS 8, I said extensibility was going to be one of the biggest breakthroughs Apple has ever done. And I think I undersold it, because so many of the new technologies, from content blockers to video game recording to all these views that are being, they've basically totally unbundled apps. Apps are not these discrete binaries that you arduously go and search for and find and launch. They're these little bits of functionality that you pull down or press into or swipe up, and little bits of apps are everywhere. And it makes the entire interface almost like it's accelerated. It makes it so much faster to use.
I think I'm going to buy a new iPhone.
Too late.
You had me at back button, actually. It's funny because iOS users mocked Android mercilessly for the back button. It was one of the features that made me move to Android.
Well, this is subtly different, that the Android back button always had two purposes, inside the app and outside the app. And Apple's got two discrete actions, one for inside and one for outside.
Good. Maybe they've improved on it. I'm looking forward to it. 2 weeks. We get it. Hey, let's take a break. We'll wrap things up. Great panel. So glad to have Renee Ritchie from iMore.com. Ben Thompson from Stratechery. If you're not, I subscribed. I finally gave in and said, this guy's too good. I have to pay for it.
I'm a subscriber.
Yeah, it's really great. Stratechery.com. There's a lot of free content, including the article.
Yeah,
we're talking
I do
about.
One free article a week, and then the other 4 days a week is subscriber only. So I do write every day, but four
all of Ben's good stuff is on Twitter, though. So that's.
Yeah, follow everybody. Every one of these three you should follow on Twitter. They're all Twitter mavens. Ed Bott, he's at Ed Bott, and on ZDNet.com. Our show today brought to you by Squarespace. One of the people we got together with when I was in New York was the great folks at Squarespace. We had a great time talking. Just so impressive. These guys have such a commitment to making a better website for you. Build it beautiful is their tagline, and it really is true. They make it easy to have a website that it reflects your style, your personality, that is absolutely yours. Not cookie cutter websites, but they do it starting with these great designer templates. They've got e-commerce. They've got all sorts of stuff. The cover pages, which allow you to have a front page that has everything somebody needs to know about you. You could, for a blog, for a website, if you're a band, they have band templates, an online store. Yes, they have e-commerce. Of course, the best 24/7 customer support in the business. And they start at $8 a month when you sign up for a year. So, by the way, every Squarespace site looks great on all size screens. That's more and more important. Squarespace is now offering you $100 in AdWords credit if you sign up for the business or commerce plan. I can go on and on, but really the best thing about Squarespace is you just go to squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. Without giving them a credit card or any personal information, you've got 2 weeks with a Squarespace site. You got the run of the place. You can do all this stuff. You can even import content from your old site to see how that would look. That's free. So you can absolutely try before you buy. Take a look at the great Squarespace apps, too. They've done some beautiful apps. Stats, everything you need. Start your free trial. No credit card required. Squarespace.com. But when you buy, I want you to use the offer code TWIT because that does two things. It lets them know you saw this on TWIT. We like that. And you get 10% off. 10% off. Squarespace. See that? The blog, the metrics, the portfolio, the note. Those are all apps. They're great. Squarespace. Build it beautiful at squarespace.com. Before we move on, anything else any of you want to say about the Apple event? There's quite a lot there. It was a 2.5-hour event, almost as long as this show. And they, I think in many ways, kind of put a stake in the ground for some very interesting new stuff. Anything you want to say about that? Are we good?
Jeez, Leo.
We've beaten it to
we're
death.
We're going longer than the event.
We did.
You teased something earlier, though, that you thought was the most revolutionary thing that you thought we were going to, like, guess.
The iPad Pro. That's what I meant. I really feel that the iPad Pro is a breakthrough. And I know a lot of people think I'm nuts.
Speakers are – we didn't talk about that, Leo. Those speakers are amazing.
You four just turn speakers. The thing,
yeah, and they go as fast as the reorientation of the app. So you're looking at something, you turn it sideways, those speakers take over, everything rebalances.
Why would you put four speakers in and not put a better camera in? I don't understand what they're doing.
I think that the idea of someone standing there with this camera to them is not as realistic as someone watching like Avengers Age of Ultron.
Real people use the iPad back for a camera. I see it all the time.
Me too, but I think those people, they think are like the... those people, if they're using iPad for the camera, the megapixel count of the camera is not the most important thing to them.
Although, I got to say, please do not use an iPad Pro to take pictures.
I want it to shoot 4K, Leo. You know what kind of a viewfinder that would be? That would be the best viewfinder ever.
I just want, you know, from when Renee just said those people, I want that clip from Tropic Thunder. You people. You people.
I'm one of them. We used the iPad to shoot everything at CES this year.
Real quickly, cyber attack exposes 10 million records at U.S. health insurer Excellus. I think they're blue something. Blue Shield. We've heard this so many times. Is there a story here?
Nope.
We're screwed.
Security's hard.
Y'all. Chris Sacca says, everybody I talk to, all the biggest Twitter investors, want Jack Dorsey to be CEO. Jack's already said, I'm too busy.
They continue.
I don't buy that. I think that Vanity Fair article that says he turned it down, I don't buy that. I suspect what it was the board offered it to him conditional on him stepping down from Square, and he turned that down.
Because that's his company. He wants to keep doing it.
Yeah, I suspect he's holding out to do both.
By the way, that article also said that the board calls Chris Sacca the Unabomber. Because
they need it. I mean, as I noted on Twitter, up your point earlier, I mean, the surprising thing would have been a fast and neat and clean CEO search. That's not the Twitter we know and love.
Yeah. It's a hot mess. Twitter, it's a hot mess. And it really is.
I mean, this is...
It's a dog's breakfast.
And yet, we can't live without it. It's the dial tone of the internet. Yeah.
RSS.
Huh?
It's the new RSS.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like that. I don't think that's a good thing to say, but...
Well, it kind of is RSS, just...
Yeah. So it's out of control. It's RSS if it were out of control. And like
the R
cancer.
Is for random. The R is for random, Leo.
Yes.
Yes.
GoPro, which announced it was going to do a multi-camera virtual reality camera, has says, yeah, it's coming out in November, and it's $15,000. Oh, man.
Alex has ordered three of them. You want to bet?
Oh, man. I did the calculations, and I thought, well, if it's got 16 GoPros in it, it shouldn't be more than $6,000. I guess I was wrong.
The tape.
It's expensive to glue it together. You know, I'm going to buy this Theta S. I figure, so this is the 3D, the Ricoh 3D camera that you just hold, and it does, you shoot video that's completely surround video. It's only a couple $100. And then I'm going to stream that to YouTube. And then I figured it all out. I'm just going to be here doing a vlog, and then on the other side of me, there's going to be a bunch of crazy people, you know, naked dancing and stuff. It'll be like I'll have Burning Man on one side, but unless you turn around, you won't notice.
We are all Roland Headley now.
Yes. You know?
We need the we
Doonesbury.
Need
another old man reference, the Doonesbury character who wore all...
Where's our 3D Periscope?
Oh, I love this. Yes, 3D Periscope. Amazon finally stopped selling the Fire Phone. Somebody in a chat room said, No, there's a guy in the chat room who bought it the day before they stopped selling it. Nice timing.
I've got one. Mine's a collector's item now. I'm really happy about that.
I gave mine to Dvorak. I thought that was a good use of it.
Oh, it reminds me of a world where... it reminds me of the fundamental difference between... The difference between... between Amazon and Apple, where, you know, a lot of times Steve Jobs wouldn't get his way, and Jeff Bezos got his way with the Fire Phone. There weren't enough people there to say, no, this is a terrible idea. We're going to do this, this, and this, and not this. And he would curse at them, go off, say they're all going to fail, and he'd fire them. But then it would work out, and everyone would be fine. So you always need those people to tell you no.
To his credit, though, and to Amazon's credit, they learn from their mistake, and they're not trying to do version two, and they're like... I mean, the issue is Amazon is a horizontal services company that needs to be reaching people on every platform, not trying to own the one. And yes, you're right. It should have never been made in the first place. And probably all of us, definitely including myself, were saying it was a bad idea from the beginning. But that said, if you're going to do the wrong thing, at least learn from it and change going forward. And they have.
Look at Microsoft. They made the Kin, and then they realized, oh, no, Windows Phone is the way.
And then 7 was the way, and then 8, and now 10.
Well, you know, that's why Nadella, though, deserves credit.
He does.
Because it was important that Microsoft was at that event, and it was important because what matters to Microsoft is not Windows. What matters to Microsoft is that Windows is now – when Windows was the market – Microsoft, the great thing about monopolies, you don't need, I talked about that whole distinction before about being a scale offering or being like a niche offering. When you're a monopoly, you get to be both. Like life's very easy. And so Microsoft never had to make these kind of trade-off decisions. Are we going to be focused on a vertical area or are we focused on a horizontal scale play? And now they do have to make those decisions because Windows is no longer the whole thing. It's only a part of the market. And Microsoft, by nature and by business model and by history, is a scale company. They're a horizontal platform sort of company, which means they needed to abandon Windows. I mean, yes, Windows is still being produced and things, but it's clearly off in its corner and it's doing its thing. And the focus of the company and all the growth is on platforms that are on Windows and are on iOS and are on Android and are on the web. And that's exactly right, exactly what they should be doing. Doesn't mean they're going to necessarily succeed. They have a lot of challenges in front of them, but at least they are finally now going down the right road. And you know, I have great respect and admiration for Nadella for having done that. And on the flip side, that was my big contention and problem with Steve Ballmer was he conflated Windows with Microsoft, and that led to a lot of blind spots.
Ed bought his product for his business.
Ed Bott, have you ever met John McAfee?
I have not. Boy, that's one of the great great, you know, things on my bucket list. I would fly 5,000 miles.
I would
to smoke a doobie with John McAfee.
Apparently, the new criterion for running for president of the United States is all my friends said I should. That's what he said. He's going to run for president in 2016. He's got his own party, the Cyber Party. He decided to run after being encouraged by almost everyone he knows and meets. I have a huge underground following on the web, said McAfee. I promise you I will win, because I have the votes, despite his DUI and gun possession.
McAfee, Kanye, 2020, baby.
Kanye's running in 2020. I think maybe, yeah.
He's just setting up for the 2020
run.
Was he on
the run in South America or something
McAfee
like that?
McAfee, Kanye. But, you know, you get those two together. It's basically unstoppable. It is literally viral marketing.
Didn't he also say that if I'm elected 1 month afterwards, I'll resign?
I'll have the spare room ready for any of you who want to move north at any time.
The entire country's becoming an Airbnb.
Don't make me show the Rob Ford video.
Do not, please.
I didn't say Toronto.
That's Renee Ritchie. iMore.com. It's always a pleasure. I'll see you back here Tuesday. We'll talk more about Apple. We didn't really talk as much as we wanted to, so
we touched on it.
A little bit we touched on it. Mac Break Weekly Tuesdays. You know what? We should just do a whole Microsoft show on Mac Break Weekly, I think.
We do, Leo. We do Google and Microsoft.
We talk about Android all the time. I know. It drives me crazy.
You know, you guys, I'm there when you're ready.
When you're ready for Windows, Ed Bott is there. Ed, it's great. Where are you going on vacation?
South America.
Nice.
We're going to Machu Picchu.
Oh. I've been to Machu Picchu. It's an amazing thing. Everybody should get to go.
It's definitely a trip of a lifetime. So we're going to Machu Picchu and we're going to be off the grid.
Yes. Not really. I was the mayor of Machu Picchu on Foursquare for many months. I kid you not. Didn't take many check-ins, just a couple. And then suddenly I'm the mayor of Machu Picchu. Something no one will remember.
Leo, I now have a purpose in life.
Now you can use Swarm. You can become. So you are able to get online there. I'm just saying. Have a great trip. It's an amazing thing to see Machu Picchu. Allow as many days as you can. And you seem like the athletic type. You might want to try the old Inca Trail to get there.
Yeah, I'm going for the pizza.
Yeah. Great pizza in Machu Picchu. I often ask, why can't California have pizza as good as Machu Picchu?
See?
And we're obviously joking. It's Ben Thompson, who is in Taiwan, and he joins us through the grace of God and the courtesy of the Chinese internet. We thank you so much for being here.
No. Well,
I know. I like to do that at least once show.
I have no great firewall to contend with.
No actually. Great firewall there.
No, my internet is better than all your guys' internet.
It is. You what a rock solid picture, and you sound great on that Heil PR40. Did we send you that, or did you just buy that on your own?
No, I think you sent it to me last year.
You sound great. Always a pleasure. And if you do not yet subscribe to Stratechery, do.
Yes, so, I mean, as I was saying, there are free articles, so don't be turned away by that.
There's great reading and fabulous illustrations, which are only going to get better with a new pencil.
Do not stop as illustrations.
No. Well, it was all a master plan by using illustrations and then starting a website and making money from it. I'm now able to write off the cost of an iPad Pro.
Oh,
so my long years of planning have come to fruition.
Thank you for getting up early and joining us. Thank you all for being here. What a fun show. I love the brain power in here. We do this show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you could join us live, that would be great. You can be in studio if you email tickets at twit.tv. And we subjected a goodly number of people today to an event as long as the Apple event. So and we covered pretty much everything in the same obsessive detail as Tim Cook and Company. If you want to be here, tickets at twit.tv. Of course, you can always watch all of our shows on demand after the fact on our website, twit.tv, or wherever podcasts are aggregated. And that is pretty much everywhere, including iTunes, the Xbox. It's called Groove now. Groove Music and all those other great places, plus the apps we have on every platform, including Roku. Thanks for joining us. Hey, I'll see you next time. Another twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Doing the twit.